Good morning, everyone. We'll let everyone get a seat here. Good morning and welcome to the San Luis Obispo County Board of Supervisors meeting for May 19, 2015. I want to remind everyone that there are hearing devices available on each side of the podium. And I'll give everyone a chance to kind of move into the room here. Okay, I think we just about have everyone. I'd like to ask everyone at this time to stand and join me in a salute to the flag.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Okay. And with that, we'd like to ask the clerk to read the changes to the agenda today, please.
Addendum to item number one, submittal of a bid opening report regarding the San Miguel Gateway and pedestrian enhancements. Staff is replacing attachment three to include attachments to the bid protest letter that were inadvertently omitted. District one. Requirements of the Brown Act have been satisfied as this notice was posted prior to the 72-hour notice requirement.
Very good. Thank you. And with that, we'll move quickly on to our consent agenda. And I'll remind the public to be sure and state your name when you get to the podium for the record. And also, there's no need to touch the microphone. It will pick you up anywhere you're standing in or around the podium. Got a few more of these. And with that, we'll open the floor to public comment on the consent agenda. So let's start with Dr. C. Height, followed by Eric Greening.
Dr. C. Height, Los Osos. And today there's numerous water things on the agenda, so I brought the family water can to just try to remind the board that until you carry your water by the bucket, you don't have a good sense of saving water. And this can was used by a family of five in Taiwan. We had a well, and we had the water pumped, and my mother had to boil and filter our drinking water, and this is what we drank it out of. Item two, current drought conditions. It's a very serious problem, the drought, and I think that there's some irresponsibility. A lot of times tenants are blamed. Renters who don't actually own the home are blamed for wasting water. But we just, even though you declared this water savings in the month of March, I believe it was, we're just now getting a notice telling us to cut back. Number three, emergency desalinization as an item on the agenda. And also, you're approving a concession at amazing water park, and I realize that this is just a concession, but how can a water park possibly be in compliance? There are responsible people in this community who are trying to save water. I see that you're putting a Water Resource Advisory Committee member on a board. Hopefully they have a good concept of what it means to save water. Because before we even got our notices that we're supposed to be saving water, I'm not using any drinking water to water plants. I'm using wash water, and I carry it because I can only carry so much. I'm carrying it in a little water can. I've turned the water off to my toilet, and since my bathtub is right next to the toilet, I'm actually bailing water from the bathtub to flush the toilet. And when you start doing it by buckets and it hurts, you start to recognize how much water goes down a toilet, drinking water going down a toilet, how much water goes to watering plants when you are carrying wash water by a little hand watering can. So hopefully the board can be the leader here in trying to impress upon the community that this is serious, the drought is serious, the drought is dire, and we all need to do our part to save water. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Eric Greening, followed by Gary Kirkland.
Thank you. Good morning. I am Eric Greening, and I'm also speaking about water, specifically item 2, the drought declaration. Looking at page 2 of the drought update under vulnerable water systems, here's some quotes from Santa Margarita. Quote, drought response level remains at alert status. An emergency ordinance was adopted limiting outdoor watering. Staff is monitoring conditions for a potential status change to critical. My question, and it's sort of a rhetorical one, is this the same Santa Margarita of which 2 weeks ago you found no level of severity in our resource management system? And remember, to qualify for a level of severity 3, the highest level of severity, you only have to see or foresee that there might be an imbalance between supply and demand sometime in the next 15 years. Why this isn't a level of severity 3, I don't know, but I would ask how and when you can revisit decisions like this without having to wait 2 years for the next update. Later in the page, on the Chorro Valley institutions, quote, discussions with City of San Luis Obispo to exchange Nacimiento for Whale Rock are being initiated if state water is insufficient in 2016. My question here is, if this is possible without the Chorro Valley intertie, which wasn't funded with earworm, I'm wondering what would be possible with the Chorro Valley intertie that isn't now. Is it still being pursued? Again, where would the decisions be made? For that matter, where will this decision be made? What is the public process? Does exchange mean horse trade? Would there be a purchase? It would be good to see some details of what's coming and when that decision might be in front of us, because the state water pretty clearly won't be there. The San Luis Reservoir carryover is draining. At the bottom of page 5 and top of page 6, State Water Board adopts 25% mandatory water conservation regulation, requiring an immediate 25% reduction in overall potable urban water use statewide. So the urban people are stepping up and sacrificing. My question then is, why isn't the oil industry being asked to sacrifice? Why is fracking still consuming vast amounts of water in our state? And maybe our county should get ahead of the curve and not let it cross into our county until this drought is over. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Greening. Gary Kirkland, followed by Marie Brinkmeyer.
Thank you very much. I want to address number 3, using PG&E desalination water to help Cambria. At least that's the way I read that. This seems to be a perfect example of why we should have desalinization all over the county, and that we wouldn't have this drought problem if we just allowed and encouraged people to build desalination plants. And we wouldn't have to, like Dr. Seeheit said, live a kind of a Spartan life. We'd be able to enjoy our lives and have as much water as we needed. And we'd also be supporting the water companies, which if we cut back on our water usage, their income's going to go down. So they have two choices. They can either raise our rates or lay people off because they're not making as much money. And this has happened over and over again in times of drought. Whereas if we had desalinization and we had plenty of water, these people would still be making a living and being able to support their families. So I definitely support the idea that we get more desalinization in any way possible, and the county should encourage and allow desalinization plants all over the coast. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Marie Brinkmeyer, followed by, Bella Fontaine.
Kathleen Bella.
Madam Chairman and members of the board, I simply come as a representative for the Adult Services Policy Council to thank you for your recognition of the value of that council. The issues that we face continue to be food, lodging, medical, transportation, and now, of course, senior fraud has reared its ugly head. There's a strong commitment on the part of that council to address these issues. We've changed our targets a little bit throughout the year, and we now have an opportunity to actually solve a few problems right at that table. So I would invite any of you or any member of the committee or community to come to those meetings. There is a place there for public comment, and I think that would be valuable input for us. Again, thank you for that recognition.
Thank you, Marie. See, Kathleen Bellefontaine, and followed by Lindy Owen, please.
Good morning. Kathleen Bellefontaine, chairperson for the County Commission on Aging. On the consent agenda is the item number 35, which is the proclamation for May being the Older Americans Month. Actually was submitted by the Adult Services Policy Council to the board. I just want to speak as a member of the Adult Services Policy Council as well as the Commission on Aging for the point number two, which is whereas San Luis Obispo County is committed to helping all individuals live longer, healthier lives in the communities of their choice for as long as possible. I just want to point out that the Board of Supervisors approved the County Commission on Aging in 1984, which was made up of San Luis Obispo County residents to provide advisory recommendations to the Board of Supervisors in areas which would assure quality, adequacy, and coordination of available services for the senior population. Second point is in 1999, the Board approved the formation of the Adult Services Policy Council, made up of public, nonprofit, and private agencies who share information about home and community-based services that support wellness and independent living for county older Americans. My point is that we are one of the few counties in California that have a Commission on Aging and Adult Services Policy Council. So I point to the history of the Board of Supervisors for supporting the independence, independent living of our seniors and people who are frail. And I hope that you will continue to do so.
Thank you very much. I don't have any... Oh, Lindy Owen, and then I don't have any other requests to speak. So if I miss someone and you wish to speak on items 1 through 35 on our agenda, just please step forward. Thank you, Ms. Owen.
Good morning. Lindy Owen from Los Osos. Item 30 is the request to adopt a resolution authorizing execution, blah, blah, blah. In other words, the pipeline repair for the Nacimiento project is finally done. I think it was V. Lopez Jr. and Sons did the work, and they're getting a $50,000 bonus for finishing on earlier than expected. So I'm just very pleased to hear that that's finally going online. It's been almost a year since the pipeline the leaks in the pipeline were discovered. But I still come back to the problem with Nacimiento is, one, it's only at 26% capacity. So 100% capacity provides the water that the community needs. Just a reminder to people, the guarantee amount of water is 17,500 acre-feet is allowed to be removed from Nacimiento. Yet only 9,655 is allocated for different communities. Paso Robles has 4,000 acre-feet. Templeton takes 250. Atascadero can take 2,000. Slo City can take 3,380. and a small area in Cayucas can take 25 acre feet. That leaves it's about 40% of the water has not been paid for. The pipeline did cost $180 million to put this pipeline in, yet only 60% of the water is being paid for. I believe the county then must be footing the bill for the rest of the construction of that pipeline. So all is good in that it's working again, but it's been offline for a year. I really do not want to see dependency on that resource for future building. That should be an emergency backup. And I know that there's water still available and there's supposedly an excess that wasn't used this year, but it is emergency water. We are going to have to rely on it, but it shouldn't be to build more houses or increase grape vineyards. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Owen. All right, that concludes our request to speak on this item. I'll bring it back to the board. Supervisor Hill, did you have any comments or wish to
put I do. Out? Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to pull number three for comments, questions, and perhaps staff direction.
Okay, great. Supervisor Meacham?
Same. Item number three and item number 30.
Supervisor Compton?
Same. Item number three and item number 21.
Okay, Supervisor Gibson?
Comments on 6 and 35. And I can do those together.
Okay. And item number three is my item of interest as well. So we'll start with Supervisor Hill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. First, I wanted to commend, this is for public's information, this is the agreement with PG&E and the county to provide desalinated water for CAL FIRE. As everybody knows, we're in the midst of a severe water problem in our community and everywhere, actually, in our state. And I think we all share the same belief that making certain that we have what we need to protect our community is the first responsibility that we all will act on. So I'm grateful and commend everybody involved, from our staff to Chief Lewin and PG&E. But I wanted to extend this a little further because I have been having, and maybe the reps from PG&E, I know they're here, if they wouldn't mind coming up to the lectern, we've had discussions about, obviously, because of the fact that we really have had not any rain for now about 4 years, and forecasts aren't looking any more promising. And we hear from a lot of people like, well, why aren't we doing more in terms of capital projects, desal being the most, probably the most popular among people. And it's a very difficult thing. But because PG&E has a large desalination plant on their site that I've toured, and so has Supervisor Compton, I have been talking to PG&E for almost a year about the possibility of maybe looking at the use of desalinated water in a larger way, maybe looking at they do not, just for public knowledge, and I'll let them comment, they do not produce the water at full capacity. We'd love to be able to have them do that and figure out a piping project so that we could get some of that water and get it into some of our aquifers. I think all of the aquifers, of course, are in decline right now. Whatever we can do to stabilize, maybe, you know, the nearest ones being probably South County, but whatever we can do in the short term to stabilize some of our aquifers so that we're not, you know, basically I think we all agree we don't want people having this added anxiety to their lives about whether they're going to have water or not. And so I'll turn it over to PG&E, if that's okay, Madam Chair, to see if this is something we could start to work together on.
Great. Thank you, Supervisor Hill, members of the board. John Cho, Senior Government Relations Rep with Pacific Gas and Electric Company. I'm joined by Director of Technical Services, Gerald Strickland, as well as Director of Corporate Affairs, Tom Jones, and several other members of our team. So maybe just to add a little perspective, and we'll certainly get back to your question to add some context. We just wanted to say that, as you know, public safety is PG&E's top priority. We often partner with the county to protect the public safety. We train with the Office of Emergency Services and CAL FIRE consistently to make sure that we are able to respond in an emergency situation. And so we see this as the next step, as our responsibility. We have a desalinization plant, as Supervisor Hill said, that is poised to provide surplus water to help us in emergency situations. And as the agreement reads, for a nominal fee, I believe it's $3.34 per 1,000 gallons. So for the price of a Venti non-fat latte at Starbucks, that's my drink of choice, the county would have access to this water. And all kidding aside, we, like I said, believe this is our, part of our responsibility. The 20,000-plus PG&E employees, including 1,500 at Diablo Canyon, live in our community, and we want to do what it takes to keep our community safe. So with that, what I'd like to do is turn it over to Mr. Strickland and let him respond directly to your question.
Thank you. Thank you, John. I wanted to first just provide a little bit of input and insight for the public that's listening, that the desal facility at Diablo Canyon up until recently was the largest desal facility in the western United States. It has the capability of producing 675,000 gallons of water per day. For our facility, for what we call house use within the plant itself, and then also to support all the staff that's at the plant, we use about 40% of that water. And so there's a 60% additional capacity that is available that goes underutilized. So I think that this agreement is a good first step in being able to partner with the county to be able to develop a pipeline to be able to then tie into the county system.
Great. Well, I think this is, you know, the only person I've spoken to, obviously, because of Brown Act limitations, is Supervisor Compton, though I have spoken to our CAO about this as well. And as people know, you know, a desal facility is an extremely expensive endeavor. So before we would even go down that road, we certainly would rather find out how we can access the existing and partner with PG&E. As mentioned, somebody we partner with quite a lot, and that's why we have the emergency water available on this contract. But I would like to direct staff. I know that Supervisor Compton had asked a few weeks back about having them explore desal options. We have a specific one here. Maybe within 120 days at the most, we could come back with a logistics report where you're working with PG&E and identifying here are the things that we need to do to be able to make this surplus water available and pipe it into our community so that it can, you know, and how whatever the technical aspects of it that would be required. And
is that a motion? If it is, I will second it.
Yes, and I'd also like to include, perhaps since we have spoken about the Supervisor Compton, we could serve as a sort of subcommittee from the board to the Drought Task Force and PG&E, so that, you know, we're kind of tracking this, because this, you know, we're all five of us are hearing every day about water from our constituents, and we have an opportunity here to do something very concrete and specific. So let's track it. 120 days seem reasonable to let me ask PG&E and then our folks, getting a sense of how this would work logistically.
I think we can work under that type of timeline.
Mr. Buckshy?
We can certainly explore it and provide updates in 120 days.
Okay, sure. Great. So that everything I've said there, seconded by Ms. Compton, yes?
Okay.
It is. I'm so excited to look forward to this. I know you're not using your full capacity, and this is just really exciting to be able to have a backup situation, if possible and if feasible. And in speaking to you, I'm so pleased you're on board with looking at further options beyond just the emergency situation. So thank you.
Yeah, and as Mr. Strickland said, we certainly are willing to explore those options, as long as I think the county would be the lead. We see this being a partnership and working in a collaborative manner through your drought task force. And so in that time period, we would come back. But we certainly asked the group to take a look at, as you said, Supervisor Hill, some of the permitting issues that can be somewhat challenging. So we would like the county, if you could lay out the organization and what that might look like. I think we certainly want to work with you in a collaborative manner.
Very good. We have a motion and a second, but under discussion, Supervisor Meacham.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I did speak with you gentlemen yesterday. This isn't something that just has popped up. I mean, the Drought Task Force has talked about this for well over a year. And Chief Lewin, I got to hand a lot of credit to him. When we engaged in this discussion, Chief Lewin went to PG&E and talked to them about this possibility, and so it's starting to evolve. So this is going to be, I think, the beginning of a larger discussion relative to what we're going to be able to accomplish in terms of our water situation throughout the county. And I think that this would be a tremendous partnership and a great first step to try to figure this out. And kind of going back to item 30, which kind of basically ties into the water discussion, we need to figure out a way. My hope and my dream for the future of this county is that we have the ability to transfer water where we need it, when we need it, within this county. And I think we have the resources to do it. We just have to have the funding and the will to keep pushing forward with it. And I think this is a great first step. So I commend both of you. Thank you. And PG&E, thank you.
This sounds like quite a reasonable direction to head, and look forward to updates.
And also, I do sit on the county's drought task force, and I'm pretty well aware of what we're doing here. So
great. And for myself, I want to thank you, PG&E, for providing us access to an existing desal facility that, you know, the size that you have. I know our community of Cambria has looked at desal in this present drought cycle, and I'm really excited to see how we can work this into a viable solution to some of our water shortage issues. So thank you so much for being here. With that, we have a motion, and I will
a second.
Taking on a voice.
And a second. I think we need a roll call vote on this.
We can do a voice vote.
Voice vote. All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? And any abstentions? Very good. It looks
so
like
you.
We'll
stay
be working
tuned less
with
than 120 days. Hopefully we'll have before us something that that we can move ahead with. I feel really confident about it. If we're able to help our emergency responders maintain what they need for fire suppression, the next step, obviously, that we want to do is make sure that our residents are able to have a certain amount of anxiety relief, knowing that we're going to provide more water. So thank you so much.
And thank you all for what you do.
Thanks. And with that, we'll move along here. Supervisor
yesterday, and she didn't know if she was going to be able to make it or not, but I just want to recognize all the efforts of the Rotary Club and Deanna. It's somewhat of a memorial to Paul, our supervisor that passed away. So that was what I wanted to mention about that. So thank you.
Very good. Thank you. And Supervisor Gibson, item number 6. And
thank you, Madam Chair. I was as I was thinking, you know, we're going to be honoring some extraordinary youth here in just a little bit. I was greatly pleased to have Ms. Bellefontaine, Ms. Brinkmeyer here speaking to item 35, which is a resolution observing older Americans Month. Also on our agenda is item number 6, which is a resolution honoring the work of the volunteers for the Retired Senior Volunteer Program. And they are a remarkable group of older residents of this county. In 2014, 950 volunteers put in 162,000 hours of volunteer work. And their contributions to this community can't be understated. I wanted to emphasize their work, thank the Commission on Aging and the Adult Services Policy Council for bringing our attention to both things, and indicate to the high school seniors in the audience that you have a long life ahead of you and lots of opportunity to do wonderful things. Look to some of our senior folks in this community, and you will see a remarkable record of contribution. With that,
I just had one comment, and it kind of echoes what Supervisor Gibson said. I too want to thank Ms. Brinkmeyer. I don't know where she went, but and Ms. Bellefontaine for all the work you do—a tremendous amount of work, organizing everything you do—and I know to benefit the seniors in our community. So thank you, and thanks for being here. And with that, we need...
I would move the approval of the consent calendar as amended.
Second.
Very good. A roll call, please.
Mr. Meacham?
Yes, ma'am.
Mr. Hill?
Yes.
Mr. Gibson?
Yes.
Ms. Compton?
Yes, ma'am.
And Ms. Arnold?
Yes. And with that, we're looking forward to the next item on our agenda, and really want to welcome all of the students here today and their parents. This, I think, is one of the favorite days in for all of us here up on the board to have you join us so that we can be part of these wonderful presentations. So before we start...
do we need a presentation motion?
Yeah, we do. Yeah. Again, I just want to thank you all for being here, and I'll ask for a motion to approve this presentation calendar.
So moved.
Motion.
Second.
Supervisor Gibson, Supervisor Meacham, and we need a roll call, please.
Mr. Gibson?
Yes.
Mr. Meacham?
Yes, ma'am.
Mr. Hill?
Yes.
Ms. Compton?
Yes, ma'am.
And Ms. Arnold?
Yes. Thank you. So thanks today to the San Luis Obispo County Community Foundation Board and the Richard J. Weyrich Leadership Scholarship Awards for bringing this again into our chambers. And with that, I'm going to ask Dr. Jim Brescia and Don Clifford to step forward, and we'll begin our presentation. Heidi McPherson? Thanks, Heidi. You've got the wrong name here.
Good morning. Yeah. It's okay. I'm happy to follow those two gentlemen, but I'm more honored to be first.
Very good. Yeah.
To thank you all. I'm Heidi McPherson, the CEO of the Community Foundation, and on behalf of the Community Foundation, we are honored to present to you these remarkable students and their families who are the recipients of the Richard J. Weyrich Scholarships. Your Community Foundation is now 16 years old. We have $48 million in assets under management, and we give away millions of dollars in grants and scholarships. The scholarship recipients that you who are with us today represent some of the best and brightest in our county. And one of the things that we're really excited about is not only do they represent the county, but these are the leaders for our counties, our communities, our state, and perhaps even our nation going forward. The Community Foundation is a catalyst and a connector for bringing together issues and needs within the county that are of concern and interest. We bring together people who care about the issues with the issues that are here. And what greater need is there than providing scholarship support for our students to continue in their education? And I don't know how many of them have been to a supervisor meeting before. Any of you been to a supervisor meeting before? This is really one of the greatest demonstrations of public-private partnerships and government at work. So I want to thank you all for your recognition, for allowing us to be here. And on behalf of the board of the Community Foundation, we're honored to present the students to you today. And with that, I think I introduce Kay Miller, the chair of the Scholarship Committee for the Community Foundation. Thank you.
Hi, good morning. As Heidi just shared, the Community Foundation of Cuesta College, the PAC and the Clark Center, the Grizzly Academy, and Hospice of San Luis Obispo. In creating this scholarship, Mr. Weyrich's wish was to encourage young people to continue their growth as leaders with service to others and to their communities. This year marks the 10th anniversary of the Richard J. Weyrich Leadership Award. In those 10 years, the Community Foundation has awarded 157 Weyrich Leadership Scholarships, totaling almost $345,000. Each year, our committee can potentially award this now $4,000 scholarship to a deserving student from each high school in the county. Our core scholarship committee consists of 8 members. For the Weyrich Leadership Award, we add 8 more community evaluators, making us a committee of 16. Some of us are here today, and please stand when I call your name. Scholarship committee members Dee Lacey, Julian Crocker, Don Clickard, and Francia Foss, and community evaluators Celia Bewley, Sandy Mitchell, Lorreen Cabrera, Doug Cole, and Gloria McGee Cole. I hope I got everybody. Thank you. Our 16 members split into 4 groups, and we each are assigned several high schools around the county, including our continuation high schools. We read and evaluate the applications online and then select candidates for interviews. Each group then travels to our various high schools and conducts personal interviews with several deserving candidates. And I have to say, we have the most fun job in the world. This is so rewarding. The best of those candidates are the terrific and capable future leaders you will meet today. At this time, I would like to introduce Don Clickard, our own example of a dedicated leader and community volunteer. Don is an Atascadero Unified School District trustee, and Don will now amaze you with the accomplishments of these inspiring young people, and we'll introduce each of them to you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Kay. Before we begin this Mr. Gibson, I want to thank you for recognizing the fact that we need to pay a lot of attention to older Americans.
Yes, sir.
Thank you very much.
Yes, sir.
Yeah. Okay.
I wasn't talking about you.
Oh, of course not, but thank you very much. Thanks, Mr. Meacham.
Yes, sir.
Okay. Madam Chair and members of the board, thank you again for the opportunity to present the 2015 recipients of the Richard J. Weyrich Leadership Award. As Kay said, it's our 10th annual presentation of this award. Seven of those years have been before you, and it has been proven to be the best decision that we made in terms of making these awards, and we thank you for this opportunity. The 13 students that we're going to introduce to you have a GPA of over 4.0, and the student's GPA is not a criteria for selection, but it's interesting to note that along with these young men and women's involvement in school, community, and family, which earned them this scholarship, they are among the top academic students in their respective schools. In addition to being honored by presentation to this board, each student will receive, as Kay said, a $4,000 award. We don't have time to share all of their accomplishments with you, but among these recipients, there are Boys State and Girls State representatives. There are student body presidents, senior class presidents, other ASB officers. They volunteered for Coats for Kids, Special Olympics. They've been Tigers at Camp Happy Talk. There's Eagle Scouts, officers of the FFA and the 4-H. And they've worked at animal shelters. They've worked at Salvation Army. They've worked at libraries throughout the county. And many of our recipients are scholar athletes, and all league and all county in many sports, including swimming, water polo, track, basketball, volleyball, softball, football, and baseball. There are enough musicians in this group to start a band, and there are dancers and more than one who is proficient in the martial arts. We said that these kids that have come before you over the last 10 years are future leaders in this community. I think, and you'll have to pick out the ones I'm talking about here, we have a potential for a Supreme Court justice and a President of the United States in this group of 13. In the interviews conducted by the members of the Scholarship Selection Committee, each candidate was able to describe what traits make a strong leader. Mr. Weyrich would have been proud of their collective observation, and according to this group, a strong leader is reflective, bold, visionary, compassionate, disciplined, a good listener, a consensus builder, a good communicator, and has a strong sense of personal and community goals, has courage and confidence, and above all, is honest and has integrity. Who have been invited by their students, and as your name is called, please stand and remain standing. From Arroyo Grande, Robin Ramsey, counselor, Michelle Walker, scholarship coordinator. Teachers, right? Thank you. Atascadero, Christine Imers, independent studies teacher. E.J. Rossi, principal. Annie Turner, teacher. Coast Union, Sherry Aguilar, resource specialist. Cheryl C., scholarship counselor. Mission College Prep, Joni Hamm, counselor. Morro Bay, Kathy Bueller-Lipsey, assistant principal. From Nipomo, John McConnell, AP language teacher. From North County Christian High School, Sean Varner, youth pastor. From Paso Robles, Ann Sponhauer, career center coordinator. And from Templeton, Lenora Jeter, guidance counselor. Thank you very much, you guys. That's and you folks recognize the honor that was bestowed on you by the students in your schools inviting you to witness this award thing for them today. Okay, here's how we're going to do this. Students, when your name is called, you please stand with your parents and give the flower to your mom or dad. And after a few words are said about you, you will hear your full name a second time. And at this point, you will proceed down to Dr. Crocker and D. Lacey to receive your awards. And supervisors, come to the front as your name is called. You know the drill, right? So after greeting each of your students, move with them to the center for a picture with your fellow supervisors behind you. And after the picture, I'll return to your seats. The Honorable Mr. Frank Meacham, District 1.
Thank you, Honorable Clickard.
Miss Amy Cantrell. Paso Robles High School, accompanied by her parents, Aaron and Tanya Cantrell. Amy told us that nothing meaningful comes without hard work. And judging by her many accomplishments, she practices that phrase regularly. Being a tiger at Camp Happy Talk has made quite an impression on Amy as she sees the opportunity to work with the hearing and speech impaired as challenging and rewarding. She was the junior class president and is now the ASB president. Amy was a Rotary Youth Leadership Award participant. She's the section editor and copy editor for the award-winning Crimson Chronicles. She's received many awards herself, including a top 10 award 2 years in a row at Best of Show Journalism Education Association National Convention. Amy is a member of the California Scholarship Federation, is a Link Crew group leader, and is an accomplished pianist, Miss Amy Cantrell. Amy will enroll at Cal Poly San Luis Obispo, where she will major in business and marketing. Mr. Mason Hargrave, Paso Robles High School, accompanied by his parents, David and Mariana Hargrave. Yes. And you gave the flower to your mom. That was very nice. All right, good. Miss Bredsteiner, Mason's engineering instructor, says, and I quote, "Mason is one of the most persevering and intelligently creative students whom I've ever had the pleasure of teaching. An original thinker, an innovative problem solver." And that's the end of that quote. I will tell you, in interviewing Mason, and all kids that we interviewed were very delightful and much fun to interview. It's, as Kay said, a very rewarding job. Mason, nice job, buddy. Mason's a karate teacher, and he tutors in Spanish. He's a computer technician, having been the co-owner of a company that built and sold 10 computers, and will also diagnose problems and repair your computer. Mason is the Robotics Club president, and he is in advanced choir. He was selected to be Boys State representative and is an accomplished guitar and piano player. In theater, he's had lead roles in the Paso Robles High School production of Guys and Dolls, Our Town, and Robin Hood. As his Eagle Scout project, he designed and supervised the development and construction of a sound studio for the Paso Robles Youth Arts Foundation. Mason's goal is to become an astrophysicist. Mr. Mason Hargrave. Mason will enroll at the University of California, Santa Cruz. Mason will enroll in physics. Your experience has been a confidence builder for this very involved young lady, Miss Dana Alpert. Dana will be enrolling at University of California at Berkeley in the fall. Dana, I don't have your major written down. What is it?
Political science.
Okay, thank you. Or the Supreme Court Justice. Yeah. Picture time. Now, are you not supposed to be down here in front where you're Mr. Meacham? Mr. Meacham?
Mr. Meacham.
Aren't you supposed to be down here for your picture in front with your folks?
You're supposed to lead them over here.
Wait, stop. Everybody over here. Yes, there you go. There you go.
Got to backdrop this.
After we've done this a couple times, we'll get it.
I knew you should have repeated the instructions twice for the supervisors.
Paparazzi. Congratulations.
Yeah. Okay.
Best of luck.
Okay.
You been called yet? No.
Angela Hollander has reminded me to let you know as parents that there's a professional photographer doing the photography, so you will be all sent a photo of this opportunity so that you don't have to come up and take the picture if you don't want to. Obviously, you can if you want, but you don't have to. And while we're talking about Angela, let's thank Angela for the phenomenal job that she does in this organization. Thank you, Angela. The Honorable Bruce Gibson, District 2. Miss Cameron Bell McTavish. Cameron is Coast Union High School, accompanied by her parents, Lakshan and Debbie McTavish. Cameron has played volleyball, basketball, and softball, and was named the most improved player 3 years. As a member of the Associated Student Body, she has served as historian and the Spirit Commissioner. Cameron is also serving as the Friday Night Live historian. She's a member of the Rotary Interact Club and was selected to be the Rotary Youth Leadership Award participant. And I will just say that that RILA program is one of the best leadership programs that our kids can go to. And we thank Rotary all over the world for allowing those selections to be made from every high school, gets several each year, and it's an excellent honor to be chosen, and it's an excellent program as well. She was a four-year member of the FFA and has been the recruiter and received the Spirit Award. She is a volunteer at the First Baptist Church and a member of the Coast Union High School Drama Club. Miss Cameron Bell McTavish. Cameron will continue her education at Cuesta College and major in communication. Jack Krull, Morro Bay High School. He's accompanied by his parents, Dan and Dina Krull. Jack was the co-founder of the Morro Bay High School Disc Golf Club. The club has many activities, including barbecues, matches, and competitions, and group members won the 2014 Morro Bay High School Mock Rock. Nice job, Jack. Jack is a swimmer and a water polo player, and in league competition, he's a four-year swimmer and has been a bronze, silver, and gold medalist in league competition. As a water polo team member for four varsity years, he was a three-year most improved and named the most valuable player. Jack has been actively involved in his church, doing many service projects, including a vacation Bible program for children in Tijuana, Mexico. He was part of the South Africa Service Project 2012, traveling to Durban, South Africa for service, remodeling a gym and church, putting on day camps for local Zulu schools. Jack is a master photographer and has participated in the Morro Bay Photo Expo and Baywood Oktoberfest Skills USA. The Photo Mentor and various other photography competitions have rewarded him with many medals. He's also done senior portraits for students at Morro Bay High. Jack is senior class president, ASB club commissioner, and a member of the student body board of executives. Mr. Jack Krull. Jack has been accepted to the university.
What's the name? I have it.
Legend Mayors.
Yep.
I mentioned to Janice Fong Wolf, who's the director of the this program, that something will happen. That's your something. It's okay. We don't. That's good. Okay, Legend Mayors, Mission College Prep. Legend's accompanied by his mother, Adrienne Mayors, and he's a very active member of the Mission student body. As the school ambassador, he represents the school at community events, tours, and speeches. He's in charge of the daily school video announcements, directing two student anchors who report school news, sports news, and cafeteria offerings. He was the student member of the WASC accreditation team and was instrumental in providing student representatives, which helped lead to a successful accreditation report. An actor and technician, he's had starring roles in the productions of Guys and Dolls and Sound of Music. Legend is a three-year varsity football player and was chosen team captain. is a peer mediator helping classmates to solve problems. Mr. Mears wrote and directed a public service announcement for the Santa Maria Boys and Girls Club and is a film reviewer for the New Times newspaper. Legend also wrote the script, cast the actors, and made a film in the Columbia College High School Film Program. Mr. Legend Mears. Legend will attend Loyola Marymount University to major in film production. Yeah. And the Honorable Mr. Adam Hill, District 3, Supervisor. Mila Dorji, San Luis Obispo High School. Mila is accompanied by his parents, Karma Dorji and Linda Wolf, and grandparents, Paul and Marion Wolf, and brother, Shea Dorji.
Yeah, sure, absolutely. We're also joined today by our very close family friend and one of my personal mentors, Dr. Rushdie Abdulkader.
As a Hebrew and Sunday school teacher, Mila is a multiple winner of the Mora Teacher of the Year Award. He is the senior advisor for the San Luis Obispo Temple Youth. Mila is a lifeguard and lifeguard instructor for the California State Parks and for the San Luis Obispo Swim Center. He received CPR and Bleeding Control Awards by the State Parks Peace Officers and received the Golden Guard Award numerous times. Mila is editor-in-chief of Myth, the San Luis Obispo High School literary magazine, which publishes poetry, prose, photography, art, and musical compositions. He is president of the Adventure Club, which seeks out new experiences and making the most of life. Co-founder of MILES, the Mentorship in Law Enforcement Services, to address social issues present in law enforcement, to educate students about careers and opportunities in law enforcement, and Mila has served as the secretary-treasurer of the Key Club at San Luis Obispo High School. He's a varsity athlete in swim and water polo and was recognized as a state finalist for the Wendy's Heisman Athlete Award. Mila is an honorary member of the Cal Poly Astronomical Society. He's a musician and has played viola in the San Luis Youth Symphony Orchestra and also plays guitar, bass, ukulele, and keyboards and performs with friends in their indie rock band, No Idea. He serves to relieve stress and form friendships with interesting people, Mr. Mila Dorji. Mila will attend Yale University following a year spent pursuing an education based on foreign language immersion and international volunteer service. Algebra, geometry, pre-calculus, can't even say it, trigonometry and calculus after school and during lunch throughout the year. She is president of the Life Water Hope Club, creating awareness and funds to supply water to regions of Africa, Central America, and South Asia. Selected as a student to do physician shadowing, she observed surgeries and was mentored by physicians in a wide variety of practices. Ms. Liesl Ebschutz. She will attend Duke University and major in neuroscience and mathematics. Okay, Ms. Lynn Compton, District 4. Miss Jenna Clift, Napomo High School. She's accompanied by her parents, Lisa and Warren Clift, and her sister, Madison. There you go. Okay, well, this is, pay attention here. From her notes, flight school. Ground and flight training in areas of pre-flight operations, climbs, descents, turns, stalls, takeoff, and landing, did not crash. Oh, love that. Jenna was the 4-H president, led the County Line 4-H Club, participated in sheep and... sheep and dog projects. And received gold medals for 4-H Presentation Day at County Sectionals and State High School Essay Competition. She was the school and county winner in the Poetry Out Loud competition and advanced to the California State Championships. Jenna is an AP scholar with distinction, having received a 4 on all AP exams taken. She is president of the Drama Club and mentors theater students on interpretations of scripts, timing, and technique, and is responsible for fundraising, auditions, and school productions. She's a Napomo High School Link crew leader and welcomes and orients new students and freshmen. Jenna has been active in Special Olympics, helping athletes with special needs in their training and participation in track and field. She herself was a volleyball and water polo player and is trained as an AYSO referee. She's vice president of Napomo High School Conservation Club and is an ambassador for the Slow Land Conservancy, working hard for the environment. Miss Jenna Clift. Jenna will be attending Cornell University, majoring in history and literature. Okay, our next recipient, Ms. Palak Patel, is not here as she and her father are attending a session for waitlisted admitted students at Brown University. Her aunt is going to accept her award, her aunt Sumi Yadaz. We'll tell you a bit of, was she here? Sumi Yadaz, is she here? Where is she? Okay. Just read a little bit about Palak, and we're sorry he can't be here, but he's that Yale University thing's pretty important, so that's good. Palak is co-president of the India Club Youth Committee and vice president of the Asian Appreciation Club. She's the gallery coordinator of the Art Smart Club and spends a lot of hours as the food drive leader at St. Patrick's Outreach Center, collecting donations, preparing food, and serving hundreds of people each Christmas. Palak is also the group leader at Bala Vihar, where she coordinates community service opportunities such as visiting nursing homes and helping in libraries. She's the food coordinator for the National Science Bowl, where she organized and prepared meals for 100 competitors plus their families and other volunteers. She's also a cross-country athlete and awarded. Ms. Ray will be majoring in bioengineering at Stanford University.
Congratulations, girls.
Congratulations. Good to see you again. Yes.
That was Lonnie Harbor. Madam Chair, Debbie Arnold, District 5. Elijah Shively, North County Christian High School, accompanied by his parents, Steve and Shannon Shively. Elijah has been the school's talent show master of ceremonies all 4 years, and as a member of student government, he was both freshman and sophomore class president. Elijah is a three-sport athlete and was chosen team captain of all three, football, basketball, and baseball, and each time was involved in CIF playoffs. He's involved in mock trial where he competed as an attorney. A scholar athlete, truly, Mr. Elijah Shively. He will be attending Cuesta College in the fall. Madison Leong, Atascadero High School. Maddie is accompanied by her parents, Jim and Kayleen Leong, and her brother, Cameron. Maddie has been a student impact volunteer at Atascadero Bible Church, where she performed teaching duties for first and second graders and worked in the nursery. She works as a lifeguard and swim instructor at Kennedy Club Fitness, and she's been an advanced peer mentor helping to mentor freshmen and sophomores. She was a leader in the Love Out Loud Committee and assisted with a senior ball at Atascadero Christian Home. As a member of ASB leadership, she has been the junior class secretary and the ASB treasurer. Maddie has also chaired many committees, including prom, winter formal, and powder puff. She was chosen to attend the National Youth Leadership Forum on Advanced Medicine at Columbia University. Ms. Leong is a co-captain of Fellowship of Christian Athletes and was also a small group leader. She is treasurer of Community Giving Back and volunteered at Operation Surf and the Food Bank. She's a three-sport athlete, a scholar athlete, a captain in basketball, and was all-league, all-county, and all-CIF in basketball. She qualified for CIF in swimming and played doubles in tennis. Miss Madison Leong. Maddie will enroll at Vassar College in the fall, and she'll play basketball and major in biology and will become a physician.
Well,
that we have moved back.
Okay, Madam Chair, and Mr. Hill, Mr. Meacham, Ms. Compton, Gibson, thank you once again for giving us this opportunity to present these fine young men and women to you. I'm sure that we'll all agree the future's in good hands, and I hope you were able to pick out that president and that future Chief Justice. It was among them. Recipients need to remain in the chambers for a group photo that's here. And everybody else, join us in the lobby for some refreshments, and thank you very much. Dee Lacey has something to say. Dr. Crocker, this will let this inside thing out here. We've been meeting doing this WIREC thing for 10 years and all kinds of other scholarships as well. And Julia and I, for a long time, were the only two men on the committee. And it didn't ever take very long before the girls were doing something really well and the boys were, you know, the boys. And so Julia and I would time it. And I think the longest it was 7 minutes before the girls got the upper hand again. Thanks, Dee. Appreciate it. Thank you again, everybody. It was really delightful. We appreciate
Thank
it.
Thank you, John. Well, this is such an impressive group of young people. I think we can all agree that the future is in good hands. I'd like to take a break, a 15-minute break, so that we can join the award recipients, and we'll return back at 10:30.
So we go out there and take a picture now?
Okay, I think we're ready to get started.
I just sit out here?
No, sir, you have to sit up here where the sign indicates your chair is. Okay. All righty. Right now it's time that we open up the agenda to public comment, and we'll begin with our first speaker, Dana Cummings, followed by Ben DeFada.
Thank you, Madam Chair, fellow board members, staff. I just want to give you guys a quick update on the veteran stand down that we had this weekend. One of my greatest honors of my job as a county veteran service officer is to work with all the heroes in our community that have signed to lay down their lives for our country, and unfortunately we have a lot of them that that come home and they're not whole. And one of the things we do as a county to support them is to hold these veteran stand down, which is where we bring many agencies together in one location from the federal, state, and local level to provide support for them and to help those ones that are having a hard time, give them a hand up and not a handout. And so I just wanted to very quickly give you some numbers from the stand down. This was our biggest stand down yet. We started on Thursday night on May 14th. We finished on Saturday afternoon, May 16th. And we had a total registrants of 166. That's up about 30 from last year. So the word's getting out. They're coming in, which is great. We had 154 male participants and 12 female participants from the different eras. We had basically about 30 from pre-Global War on Terror, and the rest of those were all younger vets. And so I highlight that just in that there's a stereotype up there of the homeless veteran in that it's an older vet, you know, Vietnam era with a long hair ponytail and doesn't want to, you know, participate. And that really is a misrepresentation of this community. It's more now, it's OIF, which is the Iraq-Afghan veterans, who are coming home and struggling to get through school. We have veterans in our community that are going to school at Cuesta and Poly that are living in their cars because they can't afford rent and such on their GI Bill. So it's a lot of younger vets that are getting plugged in as well. And, you know, I came here almost a year ago for the Supportive Services for Veterans Families program. And at that time, San Luis Obispo County had the third largest unsheltered veterans homeless population in the country. And we have improved on that. We're now fourth or fifth on that list. And with your assistance and helping with the two reps for that program, we've been able to house about 40 veterans so far since January. And so, you know, we are doing great things in this county, and I just wanted to thank you for your support for my department and for all of the veterans in the community. Thank you.
Thank you. Ben DeFada, followed by Dr. C. Height.
Good morning, Chairwoman, Sheriff, Fire Chief, and Public. And the Father here again to inform you of what's on the public's mind these days. In this Sunday's LA Times newspaper headline, there's also a watt shortage in California, meaning hydroelectric power requires a lot of water to turn the turbines, and we are pretty short of it. It shows that Lake Shasta is at 50% capacity, Trinity Lake is at 36%. Wholesome is at 54, and so forth. As you know, your Grandmothers for Peace and many of the public and I want to tell you to start the ball rolling to close down this dangerous PG&E atomic bomb generating plant. If you start it now, it still would take many years till shutdown really happens. By that time, solar would be the favorite generating way for electricity in the whole state and nation. If it was possible, the whole world would like to come to this country. Here on another page of the Tribune, subheading is, quote, Governor faces a barrage of requests for more money to aid California's social programs. You know who's going to pay for all this, as we are all already. When is this going to end? Above this, for votes to get reelected, most of this is for votes to get reelected, in most cases by local and federal politicians and others for job security. You five up there can't say it, but the public can, and they are fed up with this state and feds taxing our citizens to death. Other states are giving them homeless and undesirables a free bus ticket to California and a map to the nearest welfare office. Now, the smart thing to do is to bill these states all the costs incurred. This abuse by this government to many states are causing a housing shortage, increased crime, and a burden on our infrastructure and finances.
Thank you, Mr. DePata.
Thank you.
Thank you. Dr. C. Height, followed by Carol Goldberg.
Dr. C. Height, Chairperson Arnold, I attend board and file complaints to create a timeline. If you remember me from when I first brought my housing concerns to the board, then you remember how distressed I was, how impaired I was, and how terribly thin I was becoming. I just don't think I'm plump enough to deal with the current housing concerns that are facing the senior disabled families of Los Osos and the county at large. For the record, it was the director of the Housing Authority who supported the idea of isolating the poor at the airport. When the city said no, he came to the county. And I was there to say no schools, no public transportation, no local neighborhood grocery store. It was isolation, segregation, not integration. If it wasn't fair, then it couldn't possibly be fair housing. I have spoken before the board since 2003. How many of you on the board were interested enough to even attend? Can we see a show of hands? How many even tuned in to watch the budget hearings? The county has quite a history, including firing all the pediatricians, closing general hospitals to save money, and then hamstringing public health care. That health care hubbub about death panels going to kill granny, silly, wasn't it? Think of yourselves as the death panel, because you make the decisions on who will live, who will thrive, who will suffer, and who will die in this county. The county pain plan is still in effect for the economically disadvantaged. You only have to inflict pain in your budget decisions. You only have to stand by and allow your providers, your partners, and contractors to inflict pain. And the people will eventually give up what they love. They will give up paradise. Your diverse population, your vulnerable seniors and disabled are most likely to feel the pain, the pressure to give it up. They are the least likely to find housing, to retain housing, to be able to afford to even move. The attitude of disrespect begins at the top and filters down, all the way to the police. This is the only trickle-down effect that really works. The state and federal funds must trickle down to the poor. There must be prevention. The funds must not enrich the county departments and partners who then profit from despair and institutionalization. And Supervisor Arnold, you weren't told the truth. On April 30th, it was all about rehabbing units and making the senior disabled families pay for the rehab. And I'm advocating for a family that has a teenage son that qualifies for a two-bedroom apartment. And they are a married couple, and they are being charged $300 rent increase.
Thank you, Dr. Height. Carol Goldberg, followed by Gary Kirkland.
Hi. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Carol Goldberg, and I live in Avila Beach. A few weeks ago, I sent you an email about my concerns on the development of Wild Cherry Canyon, and thank you for your timely responses. Since that time, I have learned that there are at least two other mega projects in the Avila Beach area being considered for development. In addition to these mega projects, Harbor Terrace has already been given the green light to go ahead. The plans for Harbor Terrace include 180 RV and tent campsites, cabins, a hotel, a restaurant, and other amenities. All this is being done that draw people to Avila. This has happened numerous times to other once beautiful areas of California. As an example, on a recent road trip, my husband and I visited a place called Sturgeon Falls. We soon discovered that there were no longer any falls nor any sturgeon at Sturgeon Falls. I wouldn't want this to happen to Avila Beach. I would like to request a hold be put on any new development in the Avila Beach area until the outdated general plan is updated and a realistic traffic count is used as a measurement of traffic on the Avila Beach Drive as a guide to future development. Thank you.
Thank you. Gary Kirkland, followed by John Snyder.
Thank you. First, I've heard several speakers over the last months or so rail against railroad traffic, specifically hauling oil or other things where we could have accidents. What happened in Philadelphia last week indicates that we also need to get rid of train traffic for passengers, and therefore I'm requesting that all train rails be pulled up out of this county to protect us from the dangers of railroad traffic. Some people tell me I shouldn't be sarcastic because you won't understand it. I don't insult my audience. I think you do understand what I'm saying there, that there are always dangers in everything you do. There's always risks. And what you do is the advantages versus the disadvantages. And don't listen to people who just list the dangers. They don't list the advantages of railroad traffic. So I'm requesting that the railroad spur be approved in the county. So that we can have more oil for our automobiles, which we drive. The other is I just got back from 2 weeks in Ireland, a beautiful country, had a wonderful time there. And Ireland is a very poor country, not very poor, but they're a poor country. They're much poorer than the United States, and yet their roads are much, much better. They have excellent roads, and they spend their money on their roads. And I don't understand how a wealthy country and a wealthy county like ours has such terrible roads. And Ireland, which is a poor country, can have such great roads. And so I'm requesting that we use our resources to at least stay up with Ireland in terms of our roads and not fall behind that country. The other issue is I want to congratulate two of our supervisors, Mrs. Compton and Ms. Arnold, for protecting private property rights in their vote last week. I wasn't here to support the idea that if you own a piece of property, you should have a right to do with it as you see fit, and those people who are opposed to it should buy that property and then do as they see fit. Our country was founded on the idea of private property rights, so I want to thank both of you for standing up for the principles of this country. Thank you.
Thank you. John Snyder, followed by Lindy Owen.
Excuse me. Hello, I'm John Snyder, and 20 years ago I decided that it would be better to have local control through court management in the Santa Maria groundwater basin. To counter that, the purveyors decided to have a settlement, which is essentially a joint powers agreement. Those have produced three reports to the court that are on the court website, and I gave you a piece of paper about that. In the Northern Cities area, they're claiming that they're using 42% of their safe yield, but somehow their groundwater table is below sea level. That seems impossible. In the Napomo area, board members there claim we're pumping 6,000 acre feet more than the supply, basically twice the supply, and we've been doing that for decades. and yet the water table is above the 1975 level when the pumping was a quarter of what it is now, and that seems impossible. The county has an RMS level 3 for Napomo, and yet their water master plan shows a 1,000-acre-foot a year reduction from 2010 to 2035. And so those are inconsistent and impossible to have both those at the same time. In the Twitchell management area to the south in Santa Maria, when we started litigation, there was a massive overdraft, but now there's no problem and there's no major need to change things. And then they also point out that as part of the settlement, Santa Maria needs to get 10,000 acre-feet of wet water in order to support the export of 600 acre-feet of water to Napomo to solve the 6,000 acre-foot shortage, which is then going to solve the problem of water flowing to the northern cities where they're using half their supply and have the water table below sea level. All that seems ridiculous and impossible to me. And so my point being here, the JPA, which is supposed to have local control, has totally failed. And we're now going back
from PG&E, who spoke earlier. They said that the public health and safety was Diablo and PG&E's number one concern, and I wanted to say that actually their number one concern is profit. That is how corporations operate in our modern world here. And issues such as when we talk about the possibility of a pipeline from their desal situation, I think that we need to be very clear how much we will be looking at spending because we will be getting 60% of what they use, and it does not mean that in the future they may need more. So we may be looking at 50% of the 675,000 gallons a day. Again, let's see what it costs to put a pipeline in, to pay the consultants three or four times, to pay the lawyers, and to get the land to do it. So just buyer beware. It's a great idea, but nothing is easy in this crisis that we're going through. Another issue is that in Los Osos, recently an article talking about Cambria's desal area waters were coming out at 48 milligrams per liter, which is 7 is the drinkable standard that we are trying to reach. Los Osos built a whole sewer, a $200 million sewer, which is finishing up, based on 22 milligrams testing on all the wells in the basin. So pitifully, nitrates count sometimes when you're trying to force things through, and other times they're forgiven. So Cambria has dropped theirs down, but only at the cost of making some operational adjustments and adding a bunch of oxygen. And the use of retreated wastewater effluent by blending is not a perfect solution, though it's now being proposed and it's used worldwide. Endocrine disruptors are the items that go through and cannot be removed from treated wastewater. They're pharmaceuticals, all the waste products, colorants. I mean, we don't even want to talk about some of the stuff that comes through after it's been processed. So in Los Osos, where we're trying to save what half basin we have left after ignoring it for so many years, I think the number one step is conservation, and we are working very hard at that, but I think we need to look at the water tank issue, and again, one-fifth of the septics that currently exist and put out leach water need to be put into the sewer system so that we can wash it out each day. Thank you.
Thank you. Eric Greening, followed by Julie Tacker.
Thank you. I am Eric Greening, and wow, you know, it's hard for any of us to follow what just happened. And I think probably several presidents in succession that I'll be happy to vote for among that group. And anyway, I would like to thank you for the decision you made last week. And I recognize it wasn't unanimous, and I recognize that two of you had reasons that you weighed differently in your mind than the other three. And I certainly can understand all points of view, but I think I think the three made the right decision. The board collectively made the right decision. And it comes down to, with a conditional use permit, you need to make findings that it is not inconsistent with the health and safety of the community or communities being affected. And even though the community was along a route rather than being on the property itself, the community was affected and you found it impossible to make those findings. And certainly when we do talk about Phillip 66, that could very well be another such case, a conditional use permit on which you will have to make health and safety findings relevant to the affected communities who will be strung out along a very long route, a number of very long routes. And you have not only the federal preemption issue with the railroad tracks, you have the issue that the railroads are not applicants for anything. They can't be conditioned because they're not coming for a county land use permit. Only the landowner in the county is coming for that. And that is actually where you can make the choice that protects or does not protect people for thousands of miles. Another topic, this Thursday will be a LAFCO meeting. Probably two of you will be there, and it will be sort of a ramping up, an orientation toward the process of the application for the district in the Paso Robles groundwater basin. And I'm going to ask again.
Jurisdiction, but part of their plan, and I've read the tech memo and some of the hydrologic modeling, and part of their plan suggests that they would like to put an injection well for the treated wastewater on your airport in Oceana. So my first thought was there's a lot of permitting that would be complex using your land, number one. Number two, it's the airport. It's Federal Aviation Administration would have to approve such a use. And it is in the Coastal Commission's original jurisdiction. So there's many layers of complexities. But my first thought was, have they asked the county to use their land for such a use? What also is a bit of a concern to me is that they intend to use the Oceano municipal supply wells to one day draw that injected water into their supply, some 333 acre feet a year of the Pismo wastewater through the ground would come up into the Oceano supply. And they're trying to develop perhaps a partnership where Oceano's demographics would help in some grant eligibility for that project. And however it all plays out, I think it's important that you follow it and that you pay attention and that your land is involved in the proposal. And on a bit of a related matter, some weeks ago you had the Ferguson group here talking about your legislative platform and lobbying the federal government for different things. And one of the things that was in their packet, is that they are lobbying for some federal dollars for a recycled water project at the South San Luis Obispo County Sanitation District. And I didn't have the opportunity to ask you at the time, but I did ask the Sanitation District, what project are we talking about? Because to my knowledge, there isn't one on the table there. And why would the county pay their lobbyists to advocate for a project that's not in their jurisdiction? And the answer that has come back is they're unaware of your role and that there's any lobbying going on their behalf. So clearly some communication needs to be developed in that region of the community.
Thank you, Ms. Tacker. George Sullivan.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the board. My name is George Sullivan. I reside at 16330 Sully Springs Trail. Santa Margarita, and as well as own property in the downtown area and residential areas of Santa Margarita. I'm here primarily as a plug for Public Works. I can't say enough about how much more funding that Public Works needs. I mean, the comment made at the last board meeting on how many millions in deferred maintenance that has transpired over the years is sort of appalling, and actually gives the board a very inaccurate pulse on the needs and resources and what this county should be spending their money on. I mean, for all practical purposes, we are sort of an adult Disneyland. I mean, people come from all over the areas to recreate along the coastlines, our ag tourism, education. This is a very well-traveled county from people that come from outside of the area. And I feel we are doing a disservice to the people that live here by not maintaining the infrastructure, closing those gaps that lie between our cities that are, for the most part, now freeways, and we need pedestrian thoroughfares and right-of-ways for smaller vehicles. I, for one, was a bit disappointed on last week's hearing. It was quite a marathon, 12 hours or whatever it was, and I was thoroughly exhausted by that and end of the day. But as I recap on all that, I just have to go back to the fact that we're really not spending our money where it needs to be spent, and for that reason, facts are skewed. There's just not a good understanding of what the needs of this county are. We are taking care and actually enabling other counties to take advantage of our budget when, in fact, we should be spending our money in our county first. I mean, planning staff and Public Works, I sometimes think there's a breakdown in communications. One example I can cite is this underground service district that they're putting in Santa Margarita. It was passed by this board in 2004. But the reality is the envelope is just State Highway 58. So they're going to remove poles, but they're going to put some poles just on the other side of the highway. Now, what kind of underground district is that? I think like Templeton, Shandon, the poles should...
Good morning, and I'm Lisa Howe with the County Administrative Office. This morning I will be providing an overview of the county's financial performance as of the third quarter of this fiscal year. The third quarter spans January 1st through March 31st. And before I begin, staff is amending Attachment 3 to fix a clerical page numbering error. So the presentation today will be provided in two parts. I will start the presentation and provide an overview of the financial status, followed by Jim Erb, the county's auditor, controller, treasurer, tax collector, public administrator, who will provide a status update regarding the annual debt.
Don't you fix that title?
So moving into the financial status, overall expenditure and revenue patterns for the third quarter of fiscal year 2014-15 are consistent with those in the third quarter of the previous year. The revenue realization rates are typical for the third quarter due to the time lag involved in billing cycles and receipt of reimbursements, and because of the largest revenue sources are historically realized later in the fiscal year. The third quarter report is also typically when departments make year-end adjustments. Approximately $8.8 million in unbudgeted expenditures is projected through year-end. Of the $8.8 million, approximately $7.4 million is due to the negotiated prevailing wage adjustments granted to many employee bargaining units and the one-time $1,000 health care cost payments to all permanent full-time employees as previously approved by your board. County departments report that they are expected to absorb about 94% or approximately $8.3 million of this through a combination of salary savings as a result of staff vacancies, savings in services and supply cost, and unanticipated revenue. It's important to note that these savings would have occurred regardless of the wage increases, and the county did not hold any positions vacant or reduce any service levels as a result of the wage increases. The balance of expenditures is proposed to be covered with $494,295 of general fund contingencies. Of the total general fund contingencies, $244,295 is needed to cover the prevailing wage adjustments, and $250,000 is needed to cover unbudgeted public defender expenditures, as I will discuss in a moment. The table on this slide shows the amount needed for the five fund centers that cannot absorb all of the prevailing wage adjustments. At the time your board approved the wage increases, it was noted that departmental savings would be the primary source of funding for the unbudgeted expenditures, and to the extent department savings were not able to cover that amount, staff would recommend the board approve a budget adjustment in the third quarter. So moving into notable issues included in the third quarter report, as previously reported to your board, the clerk recorder experienced a decline in recording revenue throughout fiscal year 13-14 and the first and second quarters of this year. Recent trends indicate recording revenue is rebounding, rising from 5% from the second quarter this year. The department is now estimating that there will be a shortfall in recording revenue of about $34,000, revised from the $120,000 estimated during the second quarter report. No impact to the general fund is anticipated, as the department is able to mitigate the shortfall with unanticipated revenue and decreased expenditures. The next notable issue is a result of an increase in CAL FIRE contract cost, as reported prior quarterly reports. Due to recent state salary increases, the county's contract cost with CAL FIRE has increased. At the end of the second quarter, it was estimated that this unbudgeted cost could be as high as $763,000. However, at the end of the third quarter, the impact is now projected to be an increase of about $267,000. This revised projection is due to a number of factors, including staff vacancies, hiring at lower steps, and additional state reimbursement due to a longer fire season and some county-funded positions being assigned to fires outside of the county. County Fire projects it will be able to absorb the increase through expenditure savings with no impact to the general fund. The next three notable issues included in the report relate to the health agency. The behavioral health and law enforcement medical care budgets are expected to exceed their budgeted level of general fund support. However, overall, the health agency expects to end the year with general fund support savings of approximately $522,000 due to a significant savings in the medically indigent services program due to the implementation of the Affordable Care Act. The health agency is projecting that the LEMC budget will exceed its budgeted level of general fund support by about $162,000 due to a shortfall of Medi-Cal reimbursement revenue, as the state has not issued a protocol for claiming reimbursements for expenses associated with Affordable Care Act, as well as an increase in expenditure levels due to the prevailing wage increases, higher charges through the county's MISP program. As previously reported to your board, this is due to Medi-Cal expansion under the Affordable Care Act. Given the low enrollment rate, some of the staff assigned to MISP has been shifted to work on other programs in the health agency. Another notable issue is the expenditures for foster care and adoptions are projected to exceed budgeted levels by about $375,000, or approximately $252,000 increase to the county's share of the cost. The anticipated overage is due to several different factors that are outside of the county's control, such as an increase in foster care intake caseloads, an increase in adoption caseloads, an increase in certification costs for the Resource Family Approval Program, and lastly, there is a small number of high-needs foster children placed out of state, and these costs are borne by the county. Despite these increased expenditures, the department will be able to cover these costs with a combination of realignment revenue and unanticipated revenue with no impact to the general fund. Another notable issue, as previously reported to the board, the public defender projects to exceed its budgeted level of expenditures by about $250,000. This is due in large part to the impact of complex cases, including murder cases and a major financial fraud case. A budget adjustment in the amount of $250,000 is requested from general fund contingencies to offset these costs. It is important to note that the projected expenditures have been included in the fiscal year 2015-16 budget. Other information of note included in the report include an update of Camp Mabel French. Since the county took responsibility for Camp French on May 1st of 2014 and through March 31st, 2015, revenues have exceeded expenditures by $19,569. Employment levels at the San Luis County Regional Airport have increased by 6,763, or 6.3%, compared to the same period in fiscal year 13-14, and rounds at Dairy Creek have decreased by 8,046 compared to the third quarter of fiscal year 13-14. This decrease is in part due to a drought condition, a decline in the amount of effluent water that is transferred from the California Men's Colony, as well as on September. At the end of September, the Dairy Creek concessionaire filed bankruptcy. County Golf is currently studying options for how to manage the golf course in the long term due to the water shortages and decrease in rounds played. And this concludes the first part of the presentation. I'm now going to hand it over to Jim Erb, who will provide a summary of the annual debt review.
Okay. Good morning. Jim Erb, Auditor, Controller, Treasurer, Tax Collector. We are... Okay, we're governed by...
I don't think your mic's on.
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay, there we go. Jim Erb, Auditor, Controller, Treasurer, Tax Collector. We are governed by California state law and the amount of debt that we can issue under general obligation type bonds. It's based on 1.25% of our total secured assessed value. That would allow us to borrow up to $538 million. Currently, our GO bonds total $10.5 million. And the only GO bond that we have out there is for the Lopez Dam seismic retrofit in South County. And because of the low interest rates that we've experienced over the last few years, we've been able to take advantage of some refunding opportunities, and we refunded that debt down there, saving about $3 million of net present value, and we also refunded the county government center in 2012, saving another $3 million in net present value. Our credit rating has gone up to AAA, as you know, and by Fitch, and AA+, by Fitch and S&P on our COPs, which are Certificates of Participation. Certificates of Participation will never be rated AAA because they have a defined funding source, where GO bonds have a general tax funding source. Any revenue will pay them. So we are getting the highest rating that we can get with COPs, and when you get a AA+ COP, it's an implied AAA rating for your GO bonds. And some of the reasons that we're getting this is because we're in a solid financial position. We have strong reserves. We've got a five-year CIP plan in place. We've got a policy regarding non-recurring revenues. We don't spend it on recurring expenses. We've got a stable economy. We have government, university, utilities here. And we have a low debt burden, 2.68%. We try to stay under 5% is what the rating agencies believe is a good target, but we try to keep it lower than that. And we've managed to generate surplus through the down years since 2009. So I put together a little inventory of our debt. I tried to get more information on here, but the slide just got too busy. I wanted to put amounts that are owed and years that it'll be paid off. We do have this information in the footnote 10 of our financial statements. I also have an annual debt service right now. So we are on the hook, and when we calculate the 2.68% that I was talking about, we use general fund backed, not general fund paid. We've got some pension obligation bonds out there. These were kind of a popular thing in 2003. I'm going to spend a little more time talking about these and what I would like to do. These are general fund backed and are general fund paid. We pay them by charging a percentage. I believe it's about 6.03% right now to departments based on payroll. We have some state notes out there, and we have some other debt, none of which are county-backed or general fund paid. And most of these are for water or other type of facilities. You can see that the big ones are Nacimiento and the Los Osos. Actually, dollar amounts aren't here, but the big ones are the Nacimiento water and the Los Osos sewer assessment are the two biggest debt issuances out there. So back to our POVs. In 2003, we had, and I'm going to use some rough numbers, we were about $130 million short on our pension funding. We were paying that amount over an amortized period to pension trust based on 7.75% interest rate, which was their assumed earnings rate at the time. We found we could borrow money at a lower rate than that, we could make pension trust whole, and then we could pay back the pension obligation bonds. And the first series that we issued, the 203 Series A, is a standard bond. We were paying principal and interest, and you can see at the bottom there our interest rate varied from 1.68% to 4.54%. We have a final payment coming up on that one in September of 2017, and that series will be completely paid off. The second one is, and so my recommendation there with this one is that we make no change, we continue to pay it as we are, and that we retire that bond in September of 2017. Now, there was a 2003 Series B, and I'm going to get to that one in a little bit because we refunded that one, but I'll skip right to the 2003 Series C, which is a capital appreciation bond. And I think it's important to note that none of these bonds are callable, that we cannot pay these bonds off early without paying the full amount, except there is one thing that we might be able to do here. So these bonds, the nature of a capital appreciation bond is they're issued, and then we have a deferred period of time where we have to make any payments on them. We still accrue interest, and by the time the bonds are actually paid off, the interest is fairly high. The principal balance on this was $44 million, and we start making payments in September of 2018 on them. And these were structured to kind of deal with cash flow and increasing employee population. So over time, we kept a fairly consistent cash flow, debt service payment of about $10 million, slowly increasing up to maybe 15 at the top. But the theory at the thinking at the time was that we would be increasing employees at the same rate or at a rate that could cover the increases in the debt service. Okay, this was all done prior to the economic downturn that we had, and it didn't quite work out as we expected, although we seem to be kind of bouncing back. This one, by the time we pay it off in 2030, we will have paid just a little over $100 million in interest, almost 2.5 times the principal balance of the bonds. So these bonds now there's parts of them that can't even be issued anymore. You have to be within four times, the interest has to be under four times the principal balance, or they're illegal in California. School districts got themselves in some real trouble by issuing some of these that were six, 10 times over the amount of the principal by the time they paid the bonds off. So we're still in the range that is allowable. And I know these are still being used. I don't like them. I don't think I would ever issue one again. But the interest rate that we had on these was between 5.2 and 5.73%. So we still were under the 7.75% that we were trying to beat from what we were paying pension trust to pay this money back. That they have dropped that earnings rate down to 7.25, but this bond is still under it. So what I would like to do with this bond is I would like to try to set some money aside. I'd like to work with our Mr. Buckshy to try to come up with some funding to set this aside. And when these bonds become for sale on the open market, we can buy them. We've seen some of them come for sale at 70 cents on the dollar, so we can save some money by buying them ourselves and defeasing them at that time. But we have to be ready to do that, and our bond underwriter is they have the facilities to do that. They check daily. They watch for these. Now, the interest rates are good. I don't think we're going to see a lot of them being sold right now, but they periodically they're inherited, and there's people need cash. There's reasons that they go on the market. And I think if we can be ready to buy them, we can cut down on the amount of interest that we'll end up paying in the long run. So we've been making payments on that, interest only, and we have a balloon payment that comes due September of 2019. I found some presentations on these bonds, and the intention at the time was to refund it in September of 2019 and push it out to about 2030, continuing to make payments on it. It's something that Mr. Buckshaw and I have been talking about. We don't want to do that. We don't think we should keep pushing this down the road. We have set about $17.5 million aside to pay for this, and we think that with your direction, we'd like to try to come up with a process of getting as much money as we can to either pay this thing off completely or substantially pay it way down, and the amount that we would have to refund would be much smaller. If we don't, we'll end up with a much larger cash flow or a much larger debt service payment than we had expected. It'll go over the $10 to $15 million that we expect to see over the next 25 years. Some of the potential projects we have coming up, we're looking into Nacimiento refunding right now. We hope to refund about $109 million. When we started this process, the savings was closer to 5 and 6%, and now it's dropped. Interest rates have gone up a little bit. We haven't issued the bonds, and we're still a month away from being ready to issue them. We will hold on to them until the timing is right. My feeling is that we're going to see interest rates rise slowly, and I don't think they're going to go down once they start going up. And so these bonds are, it's an advance refunding. We can only do it once every 10 years. So it's going to be a decision we have to make. Do we take a 4% savings, which will be $4 or $5 million, still a significant amount of money, or do we wait and try to hold out and hope for a larger savings? The longer we wait, the more we have to update our bond documents and the more work that goes with it. So when we get close to that, that's a decision that Will Clemens and I will have been working on, and we'll bring back to you and decide then. Airport terminal, we've got a project that looks like it's $34 to $35 million, and these are real rough estimates that I've used here. FAA grant that's coming in, we're hoping for close to $24 million. We're not sure yet, but we should know soon, and then we'll be able to tell exactly what kind of funding the county will need to come up with for that project. And we'll try to pay for that with passenger facility charges. In fact, a big chunk of it can be covered with that, and then through airport operations, and it may even require a general fund contribution depending on changes in the operations, airport operations, and how that goes. Another one we've talked about is the animal services facility. We think that'll cost $10 to $12 million. I always estimate a little higher because these capital projects just seem to happen that way. But $10 to $12 million we think is probably something that will be reasonable for that. And we're not sure of the funding yet. I know the administrative office is looking into whether the cities will participate and how we can possibly fund that. It's really at the beginning stages, and we're quite a ways away from that. Airport, I think that we'll see something within the next month or two on where we stand and make some decisions there. And then there's a couple others that Public Works has brought to my attention, the Arroyo Grande Creek levee improvements, and Southern Cayucas needs a couple new water tanks. So in conclusion, we've been conservative. Okay, we are, and it shows in some of the things that we've done. We've got a AAA rating. That means we can borrow money at the cheapest rate that anybody out there can. And that's a tool, because I believe in many cases borrowing at a low interest rate is probably cheaper than fighting inflation and trying to save for projects and rising costs as you move forward. I think it's a tool that has been given to governments with these tax-free bond issuances, and it can be an economic boom into the communities to have some of these projects going on. So I don't know that. I think we're lucky to have something like that. We've been able to pre-fund our pension. Okay, and we're doing that again. It's about $44 million. Not many counties can do this. We pay ourselves back over the course of a year. Every 2 weeks, we get a payment back, but it saves us $1.3 million a year to do that. We're building contingencies back up. I believe we're moving from 4 to 4.5 in our contingencies in our next budget cycle. And even to be able to talk about paying off this 2009 Series A POB is something that is unique to us, I believe, as well. This is $42 million that we think that we might be able to come up with or put a big dent in it, and we've already set $17.5 million aside. Our Treasury rating has been AAA rating for the last 25 years, so I can't take much credit for that one, although I'd like to. Our pension fund is approximately 79%, and actually I just was at a meeting yesterday, so it had dropped a little bit last year.
Jim, with the advent of, I think it was either Riverside or San Bernardino, declaring their bankruptcy, left the bondholders basically holding the bag. Do you think that the bond market's going to tighten up even more than what it has in the past?
Well, I don't know. I think they're going to look closer at your credit ratings, that's for sure. And I think that bonds are one of the last things to go. And we kind of saw that in Los Osos when they went through a bankruptcy. You know, everybody got 30, 40 cents on the dollar. I forget exactly what it was, all the creditors. But the bondholders, the judge said, no, you guys, you know, you sold these bonds, you voted on it, you promised these people you'd pay them, they bought your bonds in good faith, and you're going to have to make them 100% whole. And we're still doing that. So I think bondholders for municipal bonds feel that they're, you know, things have to get really bad before the bondholders are suffered or impacted by it.
I think it lends itself to the bond rating. I mean, to be AAA rated, if you were not rated very well, you'd have a heck of a time trying to get any kind of a bond that was paying any, with any kind of good interest rate. So I think you've done a pretty good job. Thanks.
Supervisor Hill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Jim, real quickly on the pension funding. So we're in. I know you didn't have a chart up there, but just to clarify, so we are in year five of a 30-year plan to completely pay off our pension obligation. Is that the correct way to understand it?
Yes, to pay off the unfunded liability.
And our current standing is that we have 79% of it covered.
Yeah, actually 76.7. It's
okay. 76. So essentially, I guess the sort of overview here is that what you've presented to us is that we're in a position both in terms of our rating and in terms of our financial position in terms of reserves and other things to start to implement plans to pay off some of these pension obligation bonds earlier.
Correct.
If we can do so, purchasing them. Again, for the second year, we're going to pre-fund our annual pension obligation.
Correct. Just approved yesterday by
right.
the Pension Trustee Board.
And that saves us $1.3 million a year.
Yep.
And then this third part of it is continuing to move forward on the unfunded liability of pension, which we're at about 76% or so, and we're at year five of a 30-year plan. Some sense of where we get in that 30 years to fully do you have a sense of fully hitting our target early?
No, it all depends on interest rates, and we have dropped our assume rate down to 7.25% now, so
right.
It's probably more attainable. And we spoke with the actuary yesterday. We had a study, and she's sticking by the 7.25% interest rate. So if we say that's our rate and we project it out over the next 25 years, we will hit that 100% funding in 25 years.
And that tends to be a conservative or what?
It's hard to say.
Hard to say.
But I did hear a man speaking from the GFOA, the Government Finance Officers Association, about pensions and all the pension reforms that we've had and the reporting with GASB 68. And he had a really interesting point. He said, you need to realize pensions are like you've got a four-year-old child who's going to go to college when they're 18. And when they're 18, you need $100,000. And do you need the $100,000 when they're four? No, you don't. But you need a plan in place to have the $100,000 there when they turn 18 years old to fund those pensions. And that's what we have. We have that plan in place.
If I may, Madam Chair and Supervisor Hill, just to add to that, and I think Mr. Erb outlined it well, one of the things that we do is we have an actuary that assesses our pension plan every year, and they report their findings, and they just did that actually yesterday, I believe, during the pension board meeting, and they'll have another follow-up in about a month. One of the things that's really important that is even more critical than a funded ratio is whether or not the annual payments are being made in accordance to what the actuary state should be paid. And we have always done that, and we fully intend to continue to do that. By comparison, when you hear about some pensions that are highly strained, so take the New Jersey state pension, take Illinois, which is, I think, the hallmark for what not to do, they skipped their payments and either didn't make the annual payment to the pension whatsoever or paid a greatly reduced amount compared to what the actuary stated. And I do want to clarify that is absolutely not what is happening here. We do have the annual assessment, and we have been making good on that annual payment. And as such, we are on track to pay down that liability over the next 25 years.
Great. Thank you. Thank you, Jim. Mm-hmm. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Supervisor Compton.
Mr. Erb, I agree with your suggestion to pay down the Series A pension obligation bonds. I like that substantially pay them down or pay them off, so I applaud you on that suggestion. And then I would like to ask County Council.
You could vote on the rest of them all together. That would be my suggestion.
So then I would, I guess, ask Dan, then would those two items, the prevailing wage adjustment of $7.4 million and the one-time health employee care cost offset for $1,000. Do that? Do those fall under item number eight?
Believe so, but I'll defer to Elise here if you have a detailed answer.
Yeah, so number eight is all the miscellaneous budget adjustments, so it's not just the impact, really the impact of the prevailing wage adjustments and the one-time $1,000 that is needed because departments could not cover it with current savings is in number eight, but it's really just the $244,000, $295. The other budget adjustments are miscellaneous adjustments moving from unanticipated revenue, moving it in order to cover some of these, or just shifting, accepting different things. So it's just a variety, but yeah, number eight would be where that would be. Okay, so County Council then just abstain from eight when it comes to discussion.
If Rita Neal, County Council. So if your preference is to abstain, I think what I'm hearing you say is as to the $244,000 budget adjustment that is
well, I'm concerned about the prevailing wage adjustment, which was $7.4 million, the decision made on 11/25 of 2014 for those bargaining units, and then the $1,000 employee offset, which happened before the end of the year. So it doesn't look to me like those could all fall in number eight, but the adjustments toward it.
Yeah, I'm going
to. Those are my two concerns because I didn't vote on those before, so now I'm voting to take money and put it into those to cover those when it wasn't a decision that I participated in.
Right, and I'll let Mr. Buckshy explain that the budget adjustment isn't being requested for the 7.4 or the 8.1 million. There was a gap of 244,000, but he can probably articulate a little better than I can.
Of the $7.5 million, roughly, dollars of compensation increases that was planned for, $244,000 is needed from contingencies.
Number eight, then.
Yes. The
so
rest.
You suggest I just abstain from eight.
It's your choice if you would wish to abstain from eight. I'm not recommending you abstain. That's your choice if you'd like to.
Okay. Thank you.
Supervisor Gibson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd ask Supervisor Compton if she has any other reason than not being on the board for wishing to abstain on any of these.
No, my reason was those two decisions. I don't know that I would have agreed with those two decisions when they were made, but they happened before I got on the board. So I don't feel I should participate in a discussion then to cover those decisions, I guess, is how I would put it.
All right. So let me.
It's not all of the items. It's just those two issues and the decisions that were made prior to the end of the year.
Let me ask staff if there's any legal reason Supervisor Compton should abstain and not participate in this discussion.
From a legal standpoint, oftentimes abstentions occur for different a number of reasons that a board member may decide whether they have an actual conflict, whether they believe they, you know, weren't part of the initial decision, whether it's a personal reason they're abstaining. If we got into a situation where we need 4/5 vote on something, we might have to really talk about whether there's a significant legal reason to abstain, but board member can make that choice.
Right. So we didn't. I don't see any legal reason, and I'd ask maybe our CAO to comment. It seems like all the policy decisions, with which you're welcome to agree or disagree, have been made in the previous year. This is really just bookkeeping. We're moving funds from one category of our budget to another, and there's no policy really to be entertained here. We've agreed to the prevailing wage increases, and we have already dispersed the $1,000 per county employee health care offset. So I don't see we're discussing policy here. We're getting the accounts right.
I would agree that this is not a policy issue. It is to make the necessary accounting and budgetary adjustments to close out the fiscal year. Just to, you know, to back up a little bit, it's been a standard practice, and it's a very sound practice done by a lot of other organizations, that in the third quarter, we make the necessary budget adjustments. As we know, a budget is a plan. No plan is ever perfect. There are literally thousands of line items of individual expenditures and revenues that go into the budget, and, you know, not any one is perfect. And so there are some that are up, some that are down. The third quarter is when we make those adjustments for year to date, as well as project going forward for the end of the fiscal year what adjustments would be made. So really this is a managerial type item to close out the fiscal year, which ends in about 6 weeks.
Supervisor Meacham.
Yeah, just quickly, I know when I came on the board,
we were in kind of the same, we go through this same exercise every time. And so this is kind of a cleanup item, basically, to get everything balanced to where it needs to be. So I don't know. I think it's something that you could vote on, but it's your choice.
Shifting. So we're just looking at a kind of a phenomenon that we're
it's more of a startup lag effect than an indication of an adverse condition that we would expect to trend into the future.
Okay. Thank you. That was my only question. Social services as well. I noticed some of the costs. It's foster care and adoptions. And if we're just seeing a permanent trend with the expenses being increased, or if that's something that for some reason we're seeing some kind of a one-time situation. Anybody?
Emily Jackson from the County Administrative Office. It's kind of a combination of things. I think the thing that's important to remember with social services is that these are largely costs that are unfortunately beyond the county's control. The big issue that we're really seeing with foster care caseload is not so much the caseload, but the portion of that caseload that the federal government pays for versus what the county pays for. And so the amount that the federal government pays for is determined by the income levels of the biological parents. When the income so there's a threshold that has been set, and unfortunately it hasn't kept pace with inflation and cost of living increases over the years. I think it hasn't been updated since the early 90s, I believe. And so as income levels have increased, less and less, even those folks who would be considered to not have, who don't have a lot of money, the amount of money that they have has effectively not kept pace with the threshold has not kept pace with how much money they have. So they may have more money today, but the cost of living has sort of outpaced that. And so the amount that the federal government kicks in does not has not essentially kept up with increased cost of living.
So we can kind of almost assume that this is a bit of a trend that we may want to look at permanently, needing to, in other words, it isn't just a one-time revenue shortfall. It may be an ongoing one.
Yeah, it's something, at least this issue is something that we've been reporting on for a couple of years now, and so it is becoming somewhat of a trend. I know that this is an issue with social services departments across the state and I think across the country, and this is something that they've been, working with to try and get resolved. Unfortunately, at this point, it's basically been a pretty good deal for the federal government, and so I don't know that they're going to be changing it anytime soon, but that is something that we've been pushing for.
So it might be something in the future. We look to our permanent budget to kind of make the adjustment so it's not the last minute or the third quarter. I'm just wondering, because out of the however many hundreds of thousands of line items, I mean, I know it's trying to best guess it right so that there are no surprises, right?
Agreed, and I know that was a focal point for the 15-16 year budget, so we'll see how that is. A couple points that are worth noting is, while there is a bump in cost on this, it is offset with savings elsewhere in the social services budget, and they're actually projecting to end the year under budget overall. So when you look at their budget in total, they're under. This one area was worth pointing out because of this trend. One of the parts that is tricky is that when children come into the foster care system, we don't always know what they're going to qualify or not qualify for.
Right.
That being said, we do have more data here, and as you accurately noted, there does appear to be a trend, and so our social service department is taking a look at that.
Yeah, great, thanks. And then the last one, again, I'm just, because we don't often address this, the trend in the public defender's office, is that going to be something that we might look at more of a permanent need?
Oh. I guess it depends how many people are murdered in the upcoming year is the short answer, and I don't have a good crystal ball for that. Crime rates overall have held steady or in some cases have decreased. But really what it comes down to is the complicated cases and those that are covered by the public defender, and we have had what I think is an anomaly here for a bit, but what we've done intentionally is we haven't budgeted towards the high end because we really kind of tie that money up that could be used elsewhere if we don't have an an aberrant year in terms of complex cases, so we'd rather have that available for something else. We do have contingencies for this sort of thing. If you look at the fact that we have over, I believe, about $19 million in contingencies, using about $250,000 of that for, you know, unplanned complex trials is really not very big in the scheme of things. But yes, it is a point that we've looked at, and I believe in 15-16 budget we did increase the allocation to public defenders so that we can try to avoid this in the future. But this is one that is hard to predict.
And the reason I was asking on that one, I mean, we've had a lot of changes in the judicial law enforcement arena as well with AB 109, with our, you know.
But that's the unpredictable part.
Okay, thank you for all that. And then the one thing that I wanted to ask, number 7 on our staff report list where it talks about approving a budget adjustment in the amount of $370,000 to transfer funds. This might be a Jim or a question. I'm not sure. I'll look at both sites. $370,000 to transfer funds between the road fund pavement management program and then the road impact fund for the debt service on Vineyard Drive. I'm kind of wondering about that because as Mr. Buckshy knows, I was on my knees begging for more money again for road maintenance and those funds, thinking that we were going to have more money for actual road repairs. And this one sounds like, are we shifting road repair money into debt service money? That's what I'm wondering.
See, Mr. Will Clemens is here, is our expert who can comment on this. But the short answer is that when the Vineyard Drive overpass was put in place, the debt service for that, the payment, was through impact fees.
Mm-hmm.
And those impact fees have not kept pace with the debt service. So essentially, what you're seeing here is a loan from the roads fund that would be made to cover that debt service, and it would be expected, I believe, that that would be paid back eventually when the development fees eventually come in.
Yeah, Will Clemens, Public Works Department. Dan said it probably better than I could. For the past, I want to say this will be the third year that we've needed to shift funds from pavement management to pay the debt on this, and it's all because road impact fees just aren't coming in a sufficient amount to pay the entire debt service. So we hope that trend changes, but
I don't know. We've talked about this a lot. It's a chicken and an egg, especially in that area that is actually Supervisor Meacham's area. But it, the road fees are considered extremely high, and we've watched over the years. I mean, before I was a supervisor, just hearing talk out on the street that developers are they shy away from that area because of those. Impact. Oh, here comes Mr. Flynn. But so I think that it's almost safe to say unless something really changes, those impact fees are a little bit high for the development market now, and we haven't seen a lot of activity. But what I'm most concerned about right now is if we weren't taking it out of the road maintenance fee, would that money be fixing potholes?
It would be in the pavement management program, yes. So either overlay or chip sealing.
Right, but it would be bringing our road standards up. That's what that money is for. Now it's going to debt service, and the only reason I'm asking is I'll probably be trying to ask for more because what I thought we were seeing in our budget, or Frank's laughing, but what I thought we were seeing is dollars that were actually going to be used for road maintenance. And now I'm just trying to verify that $370,000 of those dollars will be gone.
Your understanding is accurate.
Okay.
One thing that Mr. Erb and I discussed as a way to mitigate this in the future is to have the general fund budget the entire debt payment and the road impact fee fund budget the entire debt payment so that if road impact fees are sufficient, they would pay the entire thing. But if there was a shortfall, then it would come from the general fund, and that would eliminate the need to do this budget adjustment every year and take it out of pavement management. That's just a suggestion for future budget years. Obviously, the administrative office would have to approve.
Yeah.
But that is
a different
strategy.
Way to do it.
Exactly.
So before we vote on this, may I ask, I guess it would be Dan, do it's coming out of the general fund. The extra money that we found available, the extra revenues to go into road maintenance was coming out of general fund anyway. This is coming out of general fund. Is it easier to do this and then beg for more money to go into the road maintenance, or is it easier to do what Will suggested and let the general fund loan out the money that isn't coming in on the
Chair, if I might.
Didn't
we add money on the road in the budget for the roads and stuff?
Yes, in the 14-15 year budget, we added several million dollars for the pavement management program for roads. Of that, to whatever the dollar amount is, $370,000 less of that several million would be spent on pavement management to cover this debt service. You know, whether it comes from general fund or roads is really six of one, half dozen of the other. And the way I view it is if we were to instead pull $370,000 from general fund in order to make this debt service, we would have $370,000 less of general fund to spend on roads.
Unless we pull from something else.
Or from something else. So it's, you know, a matter of take your pick.
That shortfall on the debt service. However, there is a number of improved tracks now, which we would see a trend of a lot of sellable lots coming forward probably in the next year. So we will start seeing an increased intake in terms of that development impact fee. And as those come in, they can be used then to be replenish the road fund so that they can be used for the purpose of road maintenance.
Well, and I know it's important to, I mean, our debt service is important, so it needs to be done, and I'm willing to vote for this today, but now knowing that we don't really have $3 million going to the roads, we only have 2.6 and change, hopefully we can have this discussion during budget hearings.
Before we do, though, you need to go to the public.
No, I know. That was just my question, and I had a couple more. So, let's see. Mr. Erb talked about setting aside money to pay back some of these bonds when they come up, and I'm just wondering, where do we see that? Do we? There's no dollar figure attached. So how do we agree to that, disagree to that, make sure that happens? What's the process for that?
Well, I think the thought would be is if your board is interested in pursuing that as a policy, Mr. Urban and I would come back, whether it's a future quarterly report or a standalone board item, to share with you what the funding source would be, what the recommended amount would be. We wanted to have the general discussion first if you thought that was a good idea to try to buy back some of these on the open market. If there is concurrence, we'll come out and have more discussion with some of our bond advisors and then come back with a more detailed plan for how to go about doing that.
So is this included somehow in your financial language, or do we need to add that to a motion?
That's actually number 12 on the staff report.
Okay, very good. And that includes then the 2009 Series A with your plan of paying that off. That's all number 12, including number 12. Perfect. And continuing to pre-fund our pension, that is included in number 12 basically too, or is that?
No, that's something we can continue to do. Once we approved the process last year,
okay.
as long as it makes financial sense and the pension trust board approves it,
okay.
We can do that annually.
And then my very last question is, Mr. Erb talked about the contingency going from 4 to 4.5, but wasn't there some discussion about that going to 5, to the 5% that we used to wish for?
In the current year, we bumped up from 4 to 4.5, and as you may recall from last week, we discussed the proposed budget for the upcoming year, which begins July 1st.
Okay.
That proposed budget contains a recommendation to increase from 4.5 to 5%.
To 5, so that's where that was. I just thought I was missing it somewhere. So those are all my questions, and I see the CAO's light on, but no, you're done.
No, if I may, briefly,
yes. Okay, sure.
Before you go to public comment, I just wanted to provide some additional context, something that we could do in the presentation next year in the third quarter. A couple things. One, we only do exception reporting, and it's something that's really important. So you heard a litany of issues that need to be addressed. Overall, we're in really good shape. We have 23 different departments, as I mentioned. We have thousands of line items in the budget. At the end of the year, we are projecting that we will be a little over $35 million under budget. And that is one of the funding sources for the upcoming year's budget. So one of the reasons that 15-16 is looking up is because departments, your board, and staff at all levels have done a good job of managing this budget, and we're coming in under budget. And I think that's an important point that we need to emphasize. The other piece, just to broaden out the discussion a little bit on the debt, obviously our debt levels are extremely low when you look at compared to industry norms. And then if you look at the pension obligation bond debt, which I think Mr. Erb was very clear on, you know, how that was issued, what the thought was at the time. But if you go back, there's about $130 million of debt that was issued in 2003. And the plan that he and I are proposing are that roughly $80 million, $85 million, of that $130 million would be paid off in 2019, which is 16 years after the initial issuance, which is a fairly aggressive approach. You don't usually see debt that's retired that quickly. So just again, bigger picture, we're projecting to be over $35 million under budget, and we're projecting to accelerate the pay down of pension debt.
Thank you for that. And I don't see any other lights on, but I for one, personally can say that I'd love to hear that, but it prompted one more question, and it was a question that I just that I had. So I'm going to ask again. You answered it earlier yesterday, but for the benefit of the public, when in the executive summary of the staff report, you talked about the $8.3 million of expensed money, but I think. And then it goes on to say the reductions in services, it will be made up by staff vacancies, reductions in services and supply costs, and unanticipated revenue. So I think that a lot.
And we have historically anywhere between a 5 to 6% vacancy rate. The current projection or vacancy rate included in the report is about 5.5%, which means at any point in time there are about 120 to 150 positions that are vacant. Even though we may be trying our hardest to fill those positions, it takes time to recruit for a position, interview for folks to accept the job, and so you have a several-month delay, and there are some savings there, and that's anticipated, and we track that, and that is used to help offset some increases. And the way I think about it is you have this huge budget, thousands of line items. Some are a little bit over budget. Others are under budget, and it nets out that we're projecting to end the year over $35 million under budget.
Perfect. Thanks for clarifying that. So with that, we'll go out to the public. We have three requests to speak here, and we'll start with Mike Brown, followed by Julie Tacker, please.
Mike Brown, representing CoLab. We were surprised to see the negotiated raises characterized as prevailing wage increases. We thought you'd gotten rid of that system. And you just negotiated them. It appears here that $2.4 million is the $2.4 million $1,000 Christmas gift to each employee back in December, which wasn't negotiated and for which the county received no tangible negotiated benefit for its effort. And then netting down about $5 million is some algorithm to do with the negotiated wage increases, and we've seen those piecemeal for different subgroups of SLOCIA, defenders, DAs, maybe some other groups, but I don't think we've ever seen a presentation or a matrix that shows all the unions and all the costs on one page for this current year. And then given the base building, what is it next year? So it's very difficult to see. So in the end, it looks like there's about $7.4 million, the most of which is salary savings, some other things. But just where do those come from? How does that lay out by department, and what does that mean? $7.4 million is a big number. Particularly as applied against the pure payroll. And we would think you'd want to sample some of the departments to say what it means. You've been told no service reductions whatsoever, no problem. But that's still a big number here. What if you had $7.4 million to put in roads? or $7.4 million to put toward that 2019 balloon pension payment. So it's a question. On the pension system, a couple of numbers that you didn't discuss today. What's the aggregate unfunded liability at the end of the last reporting period? For the last 10 years, what was the rate of return? It's said that it's being dropped to 7.25%. What has it been year in, year out for the last 10 years, which would give you some indication of the reality and practicality of that plan? And then lastly, what are the rates going to be against the budget? In other words, for every dollar you spend on payroll, how much are you going to spend on the pension system?
Thank you, Mr. Brown. Julie Tucker?
Yes, Julie Tucker.
Followed by Dale Kaustin, please.
Okay. Good afternoon now. I am Julie Tucker and first wanted to congratulate Cal Fire on their ability to work these numbers into their contract. That's difficult and appreciated. The second thing, when Mr. Erb was talking about your bond rating, and in particular that there are two general obligation bonds, and he pointed to Lopez and Nacimiento. Lopez, you'll correct it. Just Lopez? Okay. That particular bond has been slightly reduced in its rating in a report by Standard & Poor's, and I'm curious how that affects the picture overall. And then with regard to the $1,000 health benefit for all the employees, I just have to think that if we had maybe not, if we had seen Christmas in July instead of in December, that wasn't part of the staff report available online, and you had to go to the clerk's office to look at the, I'm sure it's a large document, but we've seen large documents on your website before as part of the staff reports. It felt very untransparent that I couldn't access that from home, and I hope that there's a place that we can access it, but I couldn't find it in that staff report, and maybe that can be changed, certainly when we go through the budget hearings in a few weeks.
Thank you. Dale Kaustin.
Good morning. My name is Dale Kaustin, and I'm retired as an attorney last year, but in my 35-year career, I did a lot of criminal defense. I was good friends with McGuire and Ashbaugh, who had the contract for public defending. And I also became a little bit concerned about the excess for complex cases. And since Mr. Meacham is electing to not run, I'm considering that position myself, which puts me on the other side of the fence. I am concerned about these complex cases fees, but I'm also interested in knowing, a couple of more years back, we established a procedure to collect from defendants who truly didn't qualify for a public defender or for part of their fees anyway. And I was curious as to how we're doing on collecting from those people that didn't qualify and how much we're getting back into our budget for that.
Thank you. That actually concludes our request to speak, so I'll bring it back to the board.
If you have no lights, Madam Chair, I'll move staff's recommendations.
I'll second.
Gibson, Meacham, and we'll ask the clerk for a roll call vote, please.
Mr. Gibson?
Yes.
Mr. Meacham?
Yes, ma'am.
Mr. Hill?
Yes.
Ms. Compton?
Abstain.
And Ms. Arnold?
Yes. And with that, we'll move on to, we'll move on to item 39 on our agenda and ask the clerk to introduce the item, please.
Item
item number 39, a hearing to consider public testimony regarding the renewal of the San Luis Obispo County Tourism Business Improvement District and continued levy of assessments for fiscal year 2015-2016, all districts.
Thank you.
I was going to say, if Mr. Gustin's going to run for my seat, then I'll be a good lawyer.
There you go.
And you won. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning. Well, I am Nikki Schmidt, and if I'm sitting up here, we know we have to do something about tourism. So I am here to present the renewal of the county's business improvement district, known as the CBID. A business improvement district is created to provide revenue that benefits a specific group. The CBID benefits motels, hotels, vacation rentals, and bed and breakfasts. The CBID was formed under the Parking and Business Improvement Area Law of 1989. Formations and renewals of bids are subject to written protests from affected businesses that pay a combined more than 50% of the proposed assessment. The CBID was formed on May 12, 2009, with assessments beginning on July 1, 2009. The district was formed with the specific purpose of providing a funding source to be used for the promotion of tourism and tourism-related activities within the district. One such campaign is the Highway 1 Discovery Route, which promotes the district as 10 destinations, one fantastic vacation. Yeah. This slide depicts the boundaries of the district. At the time of formation, the district was established to include the majority of the coastal area with some inland unincorporated area. The mission of the CBID is to promote the economic well-being of the lodging businesses that pay the assessment. This is done through the promotion of the scenic, recreational, cultural, and other attractions within the district, and sponsorship of such events as Coastal Discovery and Stewardship Month, or bike races like Amgen. The ordinance established the 2% assessment, and the assessment is levied on the paid rent charge per occupied room per not the activities. A public hearing to consider the continuation of the assessment is required by state statute. On April 24th, the board approved the resolution of attention, which set the public hearing for today. Copies of that resolution and notice of proposed assessment were mailed by the clerk's office to all lodging businesses within the CBID's boundaries. A notice was also published in the Tribune. We request that you take public testimony and accept any written protest and make the determination on whether there is protest by lodging businesses that pay a combined of 50% or more of the proposed assessments. And this concludes my presentation, and I'm available to answer any questions.
Any questions of the board, to staff? I'll reiterate that today we're holding the required public meeting to receive public input and accept any protests from affected lodging businesses relating to the renewal of the CBID and the continued levy of assessment. Protests may be made orally or in writing, but to count in the determination of a majority protest against the renewal of the CBID and continued assessment, a protest must be in writing. We don't have any questions from the board members. We'll now receive public comment as well as oral or written protests from affected businesses. All written protests should be delivered to the clerk of the board. My left, your right. I do have a couple of requests to speak to come forward, and we'll start with Diane Strachkin and followed by Cindy Walton, please. Thank you.
Thank you. My name is Diane Strachan, and I'm the director of the Stewardship Travel Program.
And I'm definitely here as a cheerleader today, and one for you all for the leadership that you've shown in making sure this program came about, and for our wonderful staff. We really appreciate working with Nikki, the CBID and the Stewardship Travel Program. So just to remind you, stewardship in its broadest sense means just to take care. So Stewardship Travel is inviting visitors to come here and help us take care. And it is just one of many of our programs. I love this quote from 805 Living Magazine. They quoted us in describing it. It's very succinct. Stewardship travel is a way to experience a destination in an intimate and meaningful way while doing something of value for the people and the places you visit. So we are now marketing 70 of these activities where visitors can connect in a deeper way, actually do something of value to make a difference when they're here, and also learn something. And this is the first of its kind, as you probably know, in the country. So San Luis Obispo County is leading the way. So congratulations to all of us. And we were just invited to speak in San Francisco to all the travel writers of the Bay Area, where they were applauding before we even were done with our presentation about the work that we're doing here. So today I want to share that it is more than just marketing, that we are seeing some really unprecedented collaboration with our nonprofits and all of our parks and conservation groups and historical societies in all of our little towns. So we're pretty excited about that. There's 28 of them, if I didn't say already to say that, that we're working with. A few examples are in Cambria, the local fund there just created a $20,000 budget to create a self-guided map, I guess you'd say, to 20 historical buildings. And also we are promoting that the visitors donate to help preserve the history of that area. And that's a special part of stewardship travel. Avila Beach, we just helped start a new bird sanctuary day, which was very well received. And for Los Osos and Baywood, we are now letting visitors, a new program is going to be having visitors help preserve the old ranch house by painting it once a year at Spooner's Cove there in the Montañadero State Park. Okay, so on behalf of CBID and the Stewardship Travel Program, we appreciate your ongoing support, we really do, and your great work with us in creating a meaningful and sustainable form of travel here in San Luis Obispo County. Thank you.
Very much. And Cindy Walton.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and board members. My name is Cindy Walton, and my firm, Cayucas Vacation Rentals, manages over 50 properties that accommodate visitors to our county. I have been in business for over 25 years. I am also joined by a number of other management companies in working to perfect vacation rental experiences for visitors. I wanted to speak to your board today regarding the renewal of the County Business Improvement District, to be determined, in my opinion, and some other vacation managers' opinions, but we remain hopeful. However, no direct benefits from inclusion in the TMD you will be considering have been identified to date following numerous requests. Our industry is happy to participate in business endeavors that lead to some tangible benefit for our property owners and guests. Unlike the formation of the CBID, the formation of the TMD has been pushed forward with little to no consensus from the lodging industry as a whole. What's happened is that a handful of large hotel interests have crafted the TMD with visits low and foisted upon our unique lodging types that realize no benefit. The most frustrating part is that the votes objecting to the formation of the TMD are outshadowed by large hotel interests. In real numbers, we outnumber the hotel interests by over 5-1. So much for a democratic process where majority rules. In closing, please renew the CBID today and remove vacation rentals and B&Bs from the TMD on June 10th. Thank you, and I'm available if you have any questions.
Thank you. I do not have any more requests to speak. Did I miss anyone? We'll now close the public comment portion of this item, and at this point I'd ask the clerk if they've received any protests and what the percentage against is.
We received 7 protests totaling 3.55%, which does not constitute a majority.
Okay, so I'm looking to County Council now that it is possible to close the public hearing without having to come back.
Need an agreement to County Council's office. That is correct, Madam Chair.
Okay, so I guess I'll look to my colleagues then for a vote or for a motion to adopt the staff recommendation.
So moved.
Second.
Supervisor Hill and Supervisor Gibson.
Under discussion, Madam Chair.
Yes, sir.
One question to Council. Do we need a separate motion to make findings of fact on a failure of the protest?
Need an agreement to County Council's office. I also want to clarify the motion that you are renewing the district, you are continuing the levy, and you are receiving and filing the annual report. And including in the motion, you can also make the finding that the protests were insufficient.
I'm agreeable to add that, yes.
As am I. I would only comment that I very much like the way this CBID operates at both a regional and at a community level, with half of these funds going to the region. We see things like the whole vacation on the Highway 1 corridor being promoted, and each community also then has funds to do what they think is best for promoting tourism in their industry. I think it's a broad-based approach, and I, too, look hopefully to the future for more success.
Okay. And just to clarify, just because of the type of hearing, where the recommended action that I think the motion pertains to is receiving the public testimony, which we did, but also find a majority protest has not been lodged per the numbers read into the record by the clerk, and declare the CBID as renewed and the levy of an annual assessment continued, and receive and file the 2015 annual report. That's what
that
you all.
Motion.
Okay, very good. Then we'll ask the clerk for a roll call vote, please.
Mr. Hill?
Yes.
Mr. Gibson?
Yes.
Mr. Meacham?
Yes, ma'am.
Ms. Compton?
Yes, ma'am.
And Ms. Arnold?
Yes. And we'll just quickly move into our item number 40 on our agenda today, which is the appointment to the Airport Land Use Commission. And we'll ask the clerk to introduce the item, please.
Item number 40, request by Chairperson Debbie Arnold to discuss and appoint one of the 3 applicants to the Airport Land Use Commission, Philip Corman, John Eckler, and Eric Schaefer, all districts.
Very good. And on this one, we really don't have any staff present to provide a staff presentation and opening the floor to the public comment on this item. I don't have any requests to speak, but I'm going to ask Council, may we invite the applicants up to the podium at this
time? Yes, Reed and Neal, County Council. Yeah, this is the time and place to make a decision on the appointment. So if any of the applicants are here, and if you desire to invite them to the podium to discuss why they are the best applicant, you may do that.
Do we need these?
No.
Okay, very good. If there are any applicants that would like to make any comment to us at this time, please just come forward.
Did become an alternate for Mr. Kripe, who we did select. And so my sense is, if we are to support, which I would make a motion to support Mr. Schaefer's appointment, that would create 2 alternate openings, and perhaps we can encourage the 2 folks that applied this year to the weird thing about it is that the alternates are appointed by the actual seated commissioners. So if we would encourage both Mr. Corman and Mr. Eichler to seek the alternate positions, then we really have a lot of good experience and terrific candidates involved in the process. So my motion would be to appoint Mr. Schaefer to the open position with the understanding that we're thankful and encouraging Mr. Corman and Mr. Eichler to seek out the alternate positions.
Second.
Supervisor Hill and Supervisor Gibson and Supervisor Beecham.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. I had a chance to talk to, actually, I worked with John Eichler for a little while at Blakeslee and Blakeslee All three guys, these guys are good. They're really knowledgeable about the airport, and I appreciate your comments relative to trying to find a balance between the planning issues and the airport. I spoke at length with Mr. Corman, and I was very impressed with his approach to that as well, in that it isn't to protect the airport in terms of the Airport Land Use Commission, but it's to protect not just the airport, but everybody, you know, the residents as well. So I appreciated that approach. I'll support the motion, but I will support looking to those folks as alternates as well.
Okay. Anyone else? And I just wanted to comment, too. First of all, I wanted to thank all three applicants because, you know, this is a really important position. And I agree with Supervisor Hill that it would be wonderful if the other two applicants, Mr. Corman and Mr. Eichler, would approach the commission and let them know that you're willing to become an alternate, especially Mr. Corman. When he was in my office, we discussed the fact that we might need to balance it out a little more representation from the Paso Robles Airport. It's the commission right now. All the action seems to be down here in and around the San Luis Airport, but it would be good to have that additional representation from up north. So, with that, I think we'll call for the vote, please.
Mr. Hill?
Yes.
Mr. Gibson?
Yes.
Mr. Meacham?
Yes, ma'am.
Ms. Compton?
Yes, ma'am.
Ms. Arnold?
Yes. And thank you. And we'll ask open the floor to the public on items, closed session items. Don't have any requests to speak. Miss anybody? And we'll ask council for time estimate, please.
Ms. Rita Neal, County Council. We will go into closed session on those items identified on the agenda on number 41. We should take about 20 minutes today.
20 minutes. Okay, we'll be back at 1:30. Thank you. Okay, we will resume the meeting and ask County Council to report out of closed session, please.
Yes, Rita Neal, County Council. The board did meet in closed session, and no reportable action was taken.
Great. So then now we'll move to item 42 on our agenda and ask the clerk to introduce the item.
Item number 42, a hearing to consider an update to the Growth Management Ordinance, Title 26 of the County Code, to update the fiscal year references for the maximum number of new dwelling units allowed for the Napomo Mesa area for fiscal year 2015-2016 and maintain 0% Cambria growth rate per fiscal year for the period from July 1, 2015 through June 30, 2018, exempt from the California Environmental Quality Act, CEQA, Districts 2 and 4.
Thank you. We'll look to staff.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair. Matt Jansen, Planning and Building Department. This item and the next item are related, but they're separate in that this item is an amendment and the next item is a review of the growth rate. Jay Johnson and I are here to support Joe, but Joe is the expert, so I'll hand it off to her at this point.
Madam Chair and board members, Joe Manson, County Planning Staff. The project before you today is a request by the county to amend the Growth Management Ordinance, Title 26 of the County Code. The Growth Management Ordinance was adopted by the board on October 23, 1990, and establishes a per fiscal year rate of residential growth set by the Board of Supervisors. During the amendment process last year, amendments were identified that are necessary prior to June the 30th of 2015. The amendments are fairly straightforward, and I would like to briefly discuss each proposed amendment. The first proposed amendment is to update the fiscal year date reference for the Napomo Mesa area for the upcoming fiscal year 2015-2016. This is basically, this is the first text reference. The third proposed amendment is again to maintain the 0% Cambria growth rate per fiscal year from the period July 1, 2015 through June 30, 2018, and this amendment addresses the second text reference. Therefore, it is staff's recommendation that the Board of Supervisors adopt the attached ordinance to approve the amendments to Title 26 of the County Code Growth Management Ordinance as set forth in Attachment 2. That concludes my presentation.
Thank you. I don't see any lights on right now. We do have one request to speak, so we'll go out to the public. Amanda Rice.
Good afternoon, Amanda Rice, Cambria. I am on the board of the Cambria CSD, but I'm here as an individual Cambria, not a land or a homeowner right now. These comments actually are for both of these items because they are interrelated. One of the things that occurred to me as I was looking through these items, as I do each time we have this on the agenda every year, is it doesn't seem like this policy, which was put in place a quarter of a century ago in 1990, is actually a policy that is affecting basically anything. There is no community where we've even gotten close to the building allocation limit, even in Cambria at zero, because it might be time to relook at this policy and what is the purpose of having a growth management ordinance if the limit is so high that you're never controlling any amount of growth. We haven't seen for a very long time any amount that would meet that 2.3%. It also seems a little bit like this would be a good time to be looking at the policy in light of drought. It's going to take more than 1 year to get over this drought. It will take more than one good year of rain. If it's rainy next year, that might be just a really rainy year in the middle of a 10-year drought. We don't know. It seems a little bit foolhardy to be allocating any building, residential or not. This is also one of those situations where this policy could be changed to affect some of the policies that in your housing element related to affordable housing and moderate cost housing, because you don't have you could have the number of allocations be tied to the number of low or moderate affordable housing units are actually allocated. There's a lot of things, communities that use this kind of policy to do things like you set priorities for projects instead of a first-come, first-serve. You set priorities based on their level of LEED certification or their sustainability or how close they are to infrastructure that's already in existence. There's a lot of ways that you could be using this to your advantage, and right now it seems to me you're just getting every year. You change the RMS, the Resource Management Survey, to every other year, but you're still seeing this every single year, even though the policymakers, you guys, don't actually consider whether or not that 2.3% is appropriate considering the new realities 25 years since the policy was put into place. I know you're not likely to change today, but maybe going forward this is a policy that should be reviewed in greater depth.
Thank you. No other requests to speak, so I will bring it back to the board for questions or comments. Supervisor Meacham?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just quickly, has the county ever hit that level of growth?
Yes, it did, actually. In the next item of the annual review of the growth rate, there was a period from 1999 to 2002 when all of the available allocations were utilized with the submittal of residential building permits.
Thank you.
And I had a couple of questions here. In Cambria, I mean, it just seems to me, I wasn't here in the last time you set the period of time for Cambria at 0% growth for 3 years, but and not to say that a whole lot has changed, but I would, I mean, zero is so absolute that I'm just wondering, what would be the repercussions? Because this Title 26, the Growth Management Ordinance, is addressed annually, correct?
Yes, it is.
Yeah, so I don't know why we wouldn't set that back to it. Again, zero is so absolute that we don't know what's on the horizon. If something came along that we might be interested, or they're bringing their own water, whatever it is, to tie ourselves up for 3 years, I just don't know why we wouldn't consider it annually when we consider everything else annually.
I might be able to give you a little things I would like to point out, and it's within the growth management ordinance. even though it notes that there is a 0% growth rate, it also does give the opportunity, in coordination with the Cambria Community Services District, to allow up to 8 allocations to come in per what we call either active service meters, i.e. the water's already there, you don't have to find a new source, or what's also referred to as grandfathered water meters. And we have had those through the years. This fiscal year, we've only had one so far. So there are up to 8 building permits that could come in if they have the grandfathered water meter or the active meters. What we have coordinated with Cambria Community Services District in the past, always understanding that even though we're going ahead and just doing another 3-year period, realizing that we can always revisit the growth management ordinance prior to, in this case, say, June 30th of 2018. We can always revisit it earlier to look at the possibility of changing the growth rate. This way, we don't have to change it, you know, every year. It's like, well, if we do it for a 3-year period and nothing changes, it precludes, you know, repetition every year in that regard.
So if something changed, and I know we hear a lot about, you know, when the drought ends, but I know that we've learned through this drought cycle, maybe especially, that droughts will be back, and so we have to kind of plan for the worst and hope for the best. So, but supposing a different opportunity to provide water in Cambria came along, or there was some kind of project that was so essential to the community for whatever reason. Anyway, we could always, when reviewing the growth ordinance annually, we could change that 3-year without environmental work or anything. We could always pull it back and, in other words, say next year there was a project that came along. Is it just a matter of saying we're changing it now, or once we set it into stone for 3 years, it's set? Jay, are you going to?
Excuse me. Thank you, Madam Chair. Jay Johnson, planning staff. I think overall the take is correct. You can revisit this each year and just based on new information to change that percentage growth. The only thing I wanted to add is it would require some level of environmental determination on the department's part to come to that conclusion.
To make a finding that we could back up. So, so that kind of just takes me back to the, why isn't it like every other area where we just every year take a look and see what's on the horizon in an annual basis? But anyway, you answered my questions. Thank you. Supervisor Gibson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was only going to comment that, in fact, this growth rate can be changed at any time. It doesn't have to wait for an annual cycle. And the necessary resources to get a regular pattern of growth going in Cambria are not going to sneak up on us. The Cambria Community Services District has quite a lot of work to do, and there will be an extensive discussion leading up to the time when, in fact, there are more water resources available. So continue to work with them, and when the time is right, we'll be revisiting this and hopefully within my time on this earth. I don't know. We'll see how we do it.
Madam Chair, if I may add to Supervisor Gibson's comment that the thinking of the environmental determination in all likelihood would get done prior to coming to you through such an action either by the CCSD or by planning staff in working with your board to amend some other aspect of the local coastal plan. So the environmental for this action would be folded in with other decisions that need to be made prior to coming to your board to amend this ordinance.
I know I'm looking blank, but I hear what you're saying, and it's just that I always feel like that is we never know. In other words, we set ourselves up in a way to be challenged or to you know make it's a whole nother, and it can be cumbersome exercise to try to change something once we've locked it in. So I still have a anyway. But thank you for answering that. Are there any other comments from the board?
I'll move staff's recommendation.
Welcome to District 4, but I'll...
I'll second it. I guess it does have to do with Napoma Mesa.
Gibson and Compton. And under discussion, I don't know, I still feel like... I just still feel like for flexibility reasons... that we should, that I just don't know why an exception has been made. 3 years, this would be the third consecutive three-year time period that we've kind of held that zero up on Cambria, and I'm just not feeling so comfortable with doing that. Supervisor?
Well, if I might, I understand your concern. By the same token, has been mentioned, I think that there's
26 of the County Code Growth Management Ordinance and submittal of a resolution approving the annual growth rate for the unincorporated areas of the county, all districts.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. Joe Manson, County Planning Staff. Today, Planning Staff is providing your board with the annual review of the county growth rate. I would first like to provide you with a very brief history of the Growth Management Ordinance. It was adopted by the Board on October 23, 1990. It establishes a per fiscal year rate of growth set by your board. The growth rate is consistent with the community resources established by the resource management system to support residential growth. The countywide growth rate is currently 2.3%. Napomo Mesa growth rate is 1.8%. And Cambria growth rate is 0%. It establishes a system for allocating the number of residential construction permits allowed each fiscal year. The allocation system is managed by planning staff, myself. Allocation requests are submitted concurrently with the building permit submittal. And there are exemptions in waiting lists. Currently, we have two waiting list areas, the communities of Cambria and Los Osos. And I'd like to point out that we do have exemptions, which include secondary dwellings, affordable housing, farm support quarters, and also replacement of dwellings. Excuse me. I would like to focus on two elements of the Growth Management Ordinance related first to the annual growth rate for the upcoming fiscal year, FY 2015-16, and the allowance of an additional carryover of 10% of the allotments. This slide illustrates the historical allocation use, and as we discussed in the previous item, if you'll note, from 1999 to 2002, allocations were fully utilized. I'd also like to point out in the 2003-2004 timeline, it seems like all of a sudden there's a jump in allowed dwelling units. That was a one-and-a-half-year period where we did a conversion from calendar year reporting to fiscal year reporting, so that's why it looks a little skewed. Planning staff is recommending that your board maintain the countywide 2.3% growth rate. Planning staff is also recommending that your board maintain the Napomo Mesa 1.8% growth rate. And planning staff is recommending that you maintain the Cambria 0% growth rate for the period from July 1, 2015 through June 30, 2018. The Growth Management Ordinance allows for a carryover of a maximum 10% of the previous year's allotments. This equates to 110 dwelling units. A little historical perspective, last fiscal year, 2013-14, 24% of potential allocations were used. This fiscal year, 2014-15, as of April 14th, 13% of potential allocations have been used. We did do a projected end of fiscal year. We project 16%. Staff feels that a carryover is appropriate because the two-year trend will not exceed the 2.3% growth rate. Currently, this fiscal year, as in previous years, the 10% carryover does not apply to the Napomo Mesa area. Staff recommends that your board maintain that position. This slide shows the number of dwelling units the board would authorize for fiscal year 2015-2016. The numbers would be 1,105 dwelling units countywide and 129 dwelling units for the Napomo Mesa. Therefore, it is staff's recommendation that the board adopt and instruct the chairperson to sign the attached resolution to approve the annual growth rate of 2.3% for areas not in the Los Osos groundwater basin, the Napomo Mesa area, Cambria. Approve the annual growth rate of 1.8% for the Napomo Mesa area. Approve the annual growth rate of 0% for the community of Cambria for the period of July 1, 2015 through June 30, 2018, and allow the additional carryover of 10% of last year's allocations but precluding the carryover from the Napomo Mesa area. That concludes my presentation. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Supervisor Compton, questions?
Have we ever carried over and used any of that allocation in the Napomo Mesa area in years prior for the Napomo Mesa? Have we carry over a certain amount because it's never used every year?
No, we haven't.
Okay, thank you.
No other lights on. We have one request to speak. Amanda Rice.
Thank you, Amanda Rice, Cambria. I'm not sure why, there isn't really a reason given by staff why to maintain the 2.3 would live there if you continue to allow people to build in places that have very limited in and out. Thank you.
Thank you. Back to the board. I would just ask for clarification from staff. Ms. Rice mentioned it too, but affordable housing is exempt in all areas of the county from the growth ordinance?
Right. Affordable housing, it's noted in section 26.01.034 under the list of exemptions. And I'll just go ahead and read this into the record. Proposed new dwelling units, which will be affordable housing for persons of families of low or moderate income as defined by the California Health and Safety Code, with long-term affordability guaranteed as provided by all applicable sections of the land use ordinance. So that is exempt. Okay. And we have a person on staff, Mr. Ted Bench, who handles the affordable housing, the definition of it, and confirms for us that it does qualify.
Okay, thank you. Supervisor Meacham.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Even though they're exempt, let's take, for example, the unincorporated community of Templeton, for example. And a low or moderate income, a low-income housing project was proposed, they'd still have to be able to get will-serve letters from the community service district to do that. Is that correct?
Of course, to be able to have the resources.
So there's always a check and balance in terms of the resource capability to provide for something like that.
That is correct, Supervisor Meacham.
Okay. I don't see any other lights on, so we could look for a motion here.
I'll move staff recommendation. Second.
Supervisor Meacham, Supervisor Gibson. No lights on for discussion, so we can ask the clerk for a roll call vote, please.
Mr. Gibson?
Yes.
Yes. Mr. Meacham?
Yes, ma'am.
Then Mr. Gibson?
Still yes.
Mr. Hill?
Yes.
Ms. Compton?
Yes, ma'am.
And Ms. Arnold?
Yes. And before we adjourn, I'm going to ask County Council to please clarify the item, the CBID item that we took up this morning.
Rita Neal, County Council. Item 39 that the board heard this morning was a hearing regarding renewal of the County Tourism Business Improvement District. Part of that motion or part of that process was to determine whether there were sufficient protests to which would discontinue the assessments. There were not. However, the clerk read into the record the number of written protests that we had and what the percentage of protests were. There was a slight error in those numbers, and so in order to make the record clear, I'm just going to ask the clerk to clarify the number of protests and the percentage of protests.
We received 5 protests, not 7, as I reported earlier, changing the percentage from 3.55% to 1.95%, which still does not constitute a majority. So,
thank you. Okay. So with that, we'll adjourn the meeting. Thank you.